You are listening to the Punk News Podcast after many weeks, after a year of anticipation, after a long time of negotiation, discussion, pondering, contemplation, metaphysical discussion and thought, and higher levels of debate. We are here at Punk News Podcast, episode 550, the story episode.
Woo-hoo!
Tell me a story. Remember what you said. You promised me, you said you would. You gotta give in, so I'll be good. Tell me a story, then I'll go to bed.
And here we are. It is episode 550, what you, the Punk News Podcast listener, has been waiting for. But before we start, yet again, I put my foot in my mouth, so I have to issue a disclaimer. So here's the deal, people. On episode 549, I think I was talking about how Catblight is getting really popular and blowing up. And as the little baby that I am, I said, I hope Catboy doesn't get too cool for Punk News, because that'll bum me out. Because three other bands got too cool for Punk News, and that bummed me out. And that was 7 years ago, and I'm still talking about it. And I talk about it about once a year on the podcast, because I'm a little baby. Anyways, so after we recorded that podcast, I went and saw Catboy live, and they were amazing and awesome. And I was talking to them, and we were having a good time. And then sometimes on the podcast, it really feels like we're not like it feels like we're just hanging out and rapping. And so, and also, so you kind of forget that there's people listening. And also, I used to have this ironclad rule in that like I would never talk about interviews outside of the interview itself, because that's kind of poor form, not professional or whatever. And I've gotten a little bit looser in the past few years talking about, I kind of know this band and this is how I feel and blah, 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 you know. So I saw Catblight live and I'm like, you guys are great. You guys are kicking ass. I'm so happy you guys are getting famous. And then they heard episode 549. And I tried to make it clear that I was bummed out by several other bands in the past, not several, three, that got popular and disappeared from Punk News. And I was hoping it didn't happen to Catblight. And I think I tried to make it clear that Catblight had shown none of those traits, if you will. However, I don't know if people interpreted it that way, and maybe some people interpret it in that I was saying, Catblight's getting a little too big for their britches, you know. And the reason I know this is because Catblight reached out to me, and they're like, hey, we heard your podcast, and it really kind of hurt our feelings. Like, what's up? And I was like, I'm an asshole. So anyways, kudos to Catblight for reaching out and not just kind of simmering on it and not just letting it eat at them. Honestly, if somebody's got a problem, the best thing always is to reach out. And either you can fix the problem or you can't. And if you can't fix the problem, then you just walk away and you kind of don't deal with each other, you know. The worst thing is simmer on it and kind of like spit at each other or whatever and kind of be like vague and creepy and weird, you know. So kudos to Catblight for reaching out. So they reach out to me, like, John, we were kind of bummed out. And so I said, wait, let me give you a call on the cell phone. And so I called him up, and basically, Catblight, as I understood, kind of had two concerns. A, they kind of were sad that they felt that I said that they were kind of, quote, leaving Punk News or leaving me behind, because they felt really bad about that. They said they never, ever wanted to do that. They also, and I didn't even consider this, and this was definitely my bad, they also said they didn't want other people to think that Catblight was the kind of band that would get too big for their britches and kind of blow people off, because that is not what they're about at all. I didn't even think about how my commentary would reflect on Catblight outside of my little, you know, head, if you will. So anyways, let me reiterate this, and first of all, I apologize for Catblight, and also, I hope it didn't make things weird between me and Catblight, because that would really bum me out, because I love that band, and ironically, and me talking about how things got weird with three bands in the past kind of made it weird with a band contemporary that I really like a lot. So anyways, to be clear, Catblight is an awesome band. They're one of the best bands out there. They're an amazing band. They're blowing up, and they deserve every ounce of recognition they get, and they should sell a million records. They have shown no evidence of getting too big for their britches, and to the contrary, they have been super cool and super DIY and super ground level, and they're as good as a band gets, people. So I do apologize for Catblight for I guess getting them in that little jam. So Catblight is a cool band, and they have not gone too big for the britches. It was all about me and how three bands in the past kind of bummed me out, and I was paranoid and concerned that might happen again 6 years later. But listen, I'm being a big baby. I'm being a big whiner. Three bands that I kind of like, well, that I did like, but I didn't love, got too big for the britches 3 years ago. So what? I mean, like, listen, if that's scarring me 6 years later, I'm just being a big baby and a wimp. And also, it's affecting, I guess, relationships with other bands that I have right now, which is inexcusable. So I apologize to Catblight, and then I'm going to snap my fingers. And these three bands that kind of blew us off 6 years ago I'm never going to talk about it again. I'm never going to think about it again because at this point, it's on me. It's not on them, and it's kind of ungainly. So here we go. We're going to snap our fingers, and then we're going to play some Catbite because Catbite rules, and then we're going to come back, and we're going to start the story episode of the Punk News Podcast. So anyway, Catbite cool. John is going to snap his fingers and make his weenie whining go away. Here we go. Bad influence. I guess 550. We just got started right now. Anyways, listen. First of all, we'll do real quick intros. First of all, we are here with and more and more. Are you ready for Story Week? Have you got your three stories ready for battle to see who wins the storytelling competition?
I am, and I think I'm going to take home the participation trophy.
We are also here with Chris Barrett. Chris Barrett, as an educator, what is your opinion of participation trophies? Is it a good way to inspire the youth to do their best? Or is it a teaching the lesson that everyone wins all the time, even when that's not really life? And also, are you ready for story battle?
Well, story time, story sharing, story battle, I guess. I don't know. It depends on the eye of the beholder. As for participation trophies, it's good for everyone to have something to take away, whether it's trophy or not. The whole trophy thing, I don't know. That's more sports, not really education. Like, you know, we give stars. You give checks, credits, stuff like that. But you do have to earn them. And remember, if they're having trouble earning it, move the goalposts.
Well, there you have it. Lastly, we have Hallie Bullitt, who is quite the peacemaker on the Punk News Podcast, someone who sits down and looks at all sides of a situation and is very Solomonic, if you will. Hallie Bullitt, I've been positioning story battle as a conflict, war, and a competition, which is really not in my best interest because I'm pretty sure I'm going to get blown out of the water on multiple fronts here. Hallie Bullitt, storytelling, all-out war battle to win, to be the ultimate champion, there can be only one, or a collaborative thing where we all enjoy each other and learn something new about the other.
I really hope it's the second, because I like didn't. I kind of just sat down to think about what stories I wanted to tell. I didn't really like put. I was thinking it would be more of like casual, you know, when you're just like chatting with friends and like talking about bullshit you did. So I don't know if I should have brought more of an A game if this is going to be like a Thunderdome situation.
You know what?
I'm with you, Hallie. I'm with you.
Well, you know, we're all going to get participation. So here's how we're going to do this. We're going to do this like you do kind of in like second grade when they take you to like they take you out to like some like forest and you like build like bridges. You know what I mean? Or like you like climb through tires or whatever. Or you like fall back and they have someone. Maybe that's like sixth grade. We're going to do collaborative here. We're going to hang out, have some good
time.
What
school did you go to where you do that?
I did that like three.
I didn't get cool trips like that.
I honestly hated doing that, and maybe I was being a dick at the time. Like I always felt it was like cheesy, and they would always have like these really hippy dippy like people, like you know, it's like I don't know, man. Like they'd be like, you know, don't step on the grass, you know, because you'll, you know, wear it down. It's like I'm like, lady, it's grass. It's meant to be stepped. Like you think beavers don't step on the grass? You think the groundhogs don't step on the grass? Anyways, enough of me about having my war against like Camp Pollen Wopak or whatever. Listen, it's collaborative story time. Here's what we're going to do, listeners. There's four of us, and we're each going to tell three stories. The first category of stories is going to be funny. The second is going to be sad and or poignant. And the third is going to be weird. And the way we're going to determine the order is I have in my hand the dice of destiny, a four-sided dice. I will be one. Emma will be two. Chris will be three. Hallie will be four. And before each round, I will roll the dice, and we will determine the order in which people tell stories. So this will be a practice roll. Tell me if you all can hear me rolling the dice of destiny. Did you all hear that?
I heard it.
Yep.
All right. So now we will officially roll the dice of destiny for the funny story. First person going will be me. Second person going will be me again. So second, four, me, Hallie, Chris, and then M. So okay. It's time for our funny stories, and I will start. And I forgot. Here's my funny story. So – about 4 years ago, my best friend Duncan and I went to the movie theaters. And Duncan and I have a good time, and we joke and we talk. And you know, we're kind of on the same vibe. And we went to see Guardians of the Galaxy 2. And we walk into the movie theater. And it's – you know how at the movie theater now, like, they show commercials before the previews? Like, straight-up commercials, like, buy a Swiffer Jet Duster or whatever? So I'm of the opinion that you're allowed to talk during the commercials – during the preview, you can talk if you have to, but you have to whisper. And during the movie, you're not allowed to talk at all, basically, or a very quiet whisper that's not going to interfere with other people. Do you all agree with that, or do you disagree with that concept?
I mean, it's commercial. I mean, do you really need to watch the Swiffer Jet commercial? What's the big deal?
Right, so you're allowed to talk during the commercials, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So we walk in and we sit down, and it's the M&M's commercial. And I say to Duncan, if you were one of the M&M's, which M&M would you be? And Dung is like thinking, he's like, well, there's the yellow one, the red one. And this dude, one row in front of us, about six seats down, it's him, his wife, and two or three kids. I can't remember. The kid's probably 10 or 10-ish. The dude looks exactly like Steve Jobs. He's got the round glasses on. He's bald. I mean, honestly, like if I didn't like get a good look at him, I might have said it was Steve Jobs. Or maybe Steve Jobs was dead at that point. So anyways, the guy looks over at us and he says, are you going to talk during the whole movie? And both Dung and I were like really caught off guard because we weren't even trying to be dicks. It was like the commercials. We were just talking. So Dung looks over at the guy reflexively and says, no, we're not. And like without any inflection at all, like if someone asks you, oh, do you want me to refill your bottle of water? You say, oh, no, thanks. Or no, like no inflection whatsoever. So Dung says, no, we're not. And then the guy stares at us and he says, are you going to talk during the entire movie? And then Duncan is like getting pissed off. And I'm like, what's this dude's deal? And Duncan goes, no, we're not. So like Duncan's getting kind of annoyed. So the dude like keeps staring at us and he says, are you going to talk during the entire movie? Right. And Duncan says one of the funniest lines I've ever heard him say. Yeah, probably the funniest line. He goes, do you really need to hear what the M&M has to say? So the guy stands up and he walks over and he stands in front of Duncan with his hands on his hips. So Duncan stands up and Duncan says, I can stand up too. So I stand up. I'm like, what is going on? So Duncan's a pretty big guy. I'm not a big guy, but I'm, you know, a little bigger than average. You know what I mean? Either Duncan or I could have beat the shit out of this guy. together, we literally could have killed him. One of us would have knocked him down, and we both could have stomped him to death, right? So Duncan says, I can stand up too. And, like, we're both, like, we are literally, like, I don't think I've ever been stunned in my entire – we're both stunned. We're like, what is going on here, right? So the guy, like, has his hands on his hips. He's staring at Duncan. And then he slaps Duncan in the cheek. Like he cranks up his, like, arm. Like you know when, like 40s movies, like, when a woman would slap a man? Like, don't you try to pick me up. Like, he slapped him like a woman, right? And then Duncan's, like, eyes go wide. And he turns his head and he looks over at me, right? And he is literally stunned. I'm literally stunned, right? And I can see there's this big red hand mark on his face. And the first thing I say is, Duncan, don't hit him. Don't hit him. You know, and I'm thinking in my head, we just made $5,000 each, and this is great. You know. meanwhile, I didn't see the guy, but a guy that sounded exactly like Chef from South Park says, don't fight in front of the children. Don't fight in front of the children. And I'm like, thinking, this is like the funniest thing ever. Like, Duncan just got slapped. He's stunned. The guy's standing there like he doesn't know what to do. And we just made some easy money, you know. And so I'm like, Duncan, do you want me to call the cops? And Duncan's like, he's just standing there stunned. And he's like, I think I do. I'm like, all right. So I pull out my cell phone. I'm waiting for my cell phone to turn on because we're in the movie theater. And so we're all just standing there. And the guy is like standing there. He doesn't know what to do. Like, he's in shock too, right? And so finally my cell phone turns on. And then I try to dial the number, but of course I get no reception in the movie theater. So I say, Duncan, wait here. I'm going to go outside and call the police. Stay here. Nobody go anywhere. So I go out in the movie theater, and I didn't realize, like I was so, like I was stunned that I didn't realize at the time Duncan followed me out of the movie theater. I didn't realize that. So I call 911, and they're like, hello, this is 911. And I'm like, hello, 911, my friend got assaulted in the movie theater. And they're like, in what way? Was there a weapon? I was like, well, not a weapon. He got slapped, you know? And they're like, excuse me? I'm like, my friend got assaulted in the movie theater. And then while I'm saying that, the guy runs up and starts shaking me. He goes, we're outside. Like, he must have followed us outside. He's shaking me. He's going, you ruined it. You ruined it. You ruined it. And I start laughing because it's like shaking me is like a hug, like but he's like screaming, he's red in the face, he's like, you ruined it. And I'm getting assaulted now, to like the dispatcher, you know. And then he like pauses and like his eyes get wide again and he sprints away, right? And so then Doug and I are like, sir, don't leave. So we run around the front of the movie theater and we see him sprinting into a BMW. He hops in the BMW
and speeds away.
And then we're like, did he just leave his wife and kids here? And then we see his wife and his kids like standing in front of the movie theater. And then the BMW comes whipping back around. It almost runs us over because we're like it didn't almost run us over. We were standing in the driveway. So we like step back on the curb because this car is whipping around. The kids jump in and the wife, and they speed away again. And Duncan and I are stunned, and we're like, what just happened? And I'm like, dispatcher, he's speeding away right now. And then we're like, we don't know what to do. They're like, well, we'll send a cop out. And we're like, all right. And they're like, do you need an ambulance? And we're like, no, we don't think we need an ambulance. So meanwhile, we're like, oh, man, like, what happened? God bless the teens. A teen runs out, like, I got his license plate with my phone. I got it all on camera. And we're like, oh, the teens are the best. So of course the cop gets there in like 30 minutes, you know. Mm-hmm. And the cops are like, so what happened? And we're like, he slapped us, you know. And so the cop's like, what? And we're like, he slapped us in the movie theater. They're like, well, what'd you do to provoke him? And we're like, talk about M&Ms, you know. And so we got this license plate number from the teen, and he pulls it up, and there he is. And the cop's like, all right, well, we're going to go, you know, find him, and we'll let you know what happened. So he goes away. And so then the movie theater guy comes up to us, like I, not the owner, but like the manager. And he's like, like you could tell he needed this job, and he did not need this today, you know. And he's like, are you guys all right? You want me to call an ambulance? We're like, no, man, it's cool. We know it's not your fault. And you could see the relief pour off when we said, listen, we know it's not your fault. It's not that big of a deal, you know. And he's like, well, do you guys want to go see the movie now? And we're like, we thought we walked back. And we're like, no. So he gave us two free passes, you know. And so we're like, all right, thanks, man. And so, of course, we never hear back from the cops again. And I said to Duncan, I'm like, Duncan, we really should, like, kind of go after this guy. Because, like, if his to-go-to attack is a slap, that suggests to me that, like, he's slapping his wife and kids. Like, if he punched Duncan or shoved Duncan, I'd be like, well, he's just got a hothead. But if his go-to attack with another man is the slap, you know, I'm like, that you know, that's curious. Honestly, I think we kind of have a duty to check it out. But for some reason, like, Duncan didn't want to. And I don't know if it's because he was embarrassed that he got slapped by a man. And I could have pressed it, but, like, I didn't – I mean, I'm like – in my mind, well, I got assaulted too. He shook me, you know, even though it like was, it was like a bear hug, you know, while he was screaming, "You ruined it, you ruined it." I'm thinking, what did I ruin? And I'm thinking, what I ruined, what not we, hypothetically, what we ruined is that I played out, this guy's got an anger problem. So his wife and his kids like split from him because he's got an anger problem. And this movie was like his one chance to like show his family that he knows how to behave. And these two jackasses start talking about M&Ms and like ruined his chance at reconciling with his family. And so we never heard from him again. I wanted to file a lawsuit, but I guess Duncan kind of thought it was low class. But I thought, well, no, I mean, honestly, like this guy's slapping people. That's kind of a thing. So anyway, that's how we got slapped and assaulted at the movie theater, and we got two free passes each to see a movie. So if you want to see a movie for free, because really we only got one free movie because we didn't see the movie we paid to see, so we got one free one, get slapped in the theater, and then if you really want to be smart about it, have your friends slap you. That way you each get a free
movie. Oh, my God.
So that's my
– Hooray.
Oh, my God. All right. Could I ask two questions?
Sure.
Okay. First, maybe I missed it at the beginning of the story. What movie was it?
Guardians of the Galaxy 2.
Okay. All right. I get it now. I see the demographic there in my head. All right. So that's one.
And then, see, I think the guy thought we were 12, but then when we stood up, we revealed that at the time we were like 33.
You're exhausting like you were 12.
Let me tell you something, kid. You can't talk during AMF.
Like that's Duncan's theory. Like Duncan's theory thought we were two jackass kids trying to be annoying. And then he was like, he didn't know what to do when he realized we were two 33-year-old men. But I mean, I've played it through my head a million times, and so is Duncan. And we don't really see how we were the asshole because we kept trying to de-escalate. When he said, "Are you going to talk the entire time?" we said no. He asked again, and we said no. Like, he kept escalating while we were trying to de-escalate. And then we went outside, and he attacked us. And by attacking us, I mean, shook me like you might, you know, hug your grandma or your grandpa, rather, you know.
But my friend John, cocaine is a hell of a drug. I'll tell you something.
Maybe. I mean, maybe.
And then number two. While making this for a made-for-TV movie, could those passes be actual tickets to Hamilton?
No, they were movie tickets, not theater tickets.
No, but when you adapt this to screen, when you have to adapt it to screen,
I see.
Could they be tickets for Hamilton instead?
Yes. Now we're on to something. A theater within a theater type thing. This big enough theater.
Yeah, they see that. Now you got it cooking. All right, that's what I'm talking about.
Speaking of theater, Hallie Bullitt, what's your funny story?
So I'm going with a bad tour stories theme with my stories tonight. So I got so lucky, you guys. Like, the first band I was ever in, and I did not know how to play yet. I had no business being in this band, but I got to be in the Hissy Fits, which was like a great women like pop punk band. They like put stuff out on Mutant Pop, like really, really good band that needed a bass player. And I sang and played bass, and I got asked to join, and I joined, and it was like a fully functioning band with fans. Like, already the first show I ever played was like with the Briefs. I thought I was going to shit my pants. And like, the first tour I ever went on was a tour to Europe that I like didn't have to book any of it. Like, the singer just worked incredibly hard. Her name is Holly Jacobs. She went by Princess back then, and she booked this whole incredible European tour for us by herself with no help from her lazy band members. And then there we are. We're on our way to Europe, which also, it's important to the story to say that this was right after September 11th. So that was in September, and our tour left in, I think it was December. So we were like incredibly scared to fly, incredibly, incredibly terrified to fly. So my way of dealing with this, because I'm Hallie Bullitt, human cartoon, was that I wanted to bring my childhood teddy bear with me. And the rest of the band just took like narcotics. Like, they just took like... The rest of the band just like knocked themselves out with like, maybe it was like prescription drugs. I don't even remember, but they were like passed out on the plane. And I'm just like terrified with my, and it's not even a teddy bear. He was actually a raccoon. and I named him Charmin because I'm like a child of the 80s, and I liked that those like toilet paper commercials that were like, don't squeeze the Charmin, and I like thought that'd be super funny to name that like my stuffed animal that, because of course you were gonna squeeze him. It was very funny to me when I was 8. But here I am, I'm like in my 20s, and I like am clutching this thing for dear life on the plane. And then Holly, as hard as she had tried to book this tour, is just like, I think she was in a little over her head because she had never been to Europe before. She had asked a lot of advice, but it was like not, you know, the internet wasn't, it wasn't like it was the early, early days of the internet, but the internet was not what it is now. And so it was still kind of hard to like get information and get travel information and get things booked. And she had misunderstood, and she thought that we could take a ferry from London to Amsterdam. Like literally she thought we were just going to walk down the street in Amsterdam, like to the ocean, and like get on a ferry. And that was just like going to bring us directly to where we needed to go. And that's like not how it works at all. It involves like trains, and like I had, you have to book things ahead of time. And so we realized that we were like, did not have enough time to make it to our Amsterdam show from London. We had absolutely no way of making it. And then Holly, because she was just such a trooper, just like took it on the chin and like stayed up all night and bought us all plane tickets so that we would not miss our Amsterdam show. So we fly to Amsterdam. Our flight gets delayed. We are super, super late. And there are no, we do not have cell phones. We cannot call the venue to say we're running late. It's like, we just have to fucking try to make it there. And we are like running. And we dressed like so, like the band was so like pop punk meets like Riot Girl meets like goth something. Like, so we're like in these like outlandish outfits. We have these heavy instruments and we are hauling ass down the streets of Amsterdam. We are literally sprinting with all this shit on our backs, and people are just like getting out of our way and like staring at us. And we had totally missed our set time. But we at least like we made it in time to play the show. Like they were really super nice. The other bands like they let us play later. It was like a great show. It's fucking Europe. They treat you so nicely. Like the club fed us. It was like an anarchist club, and they were like so sweet. The only thing they did that I was like, what? Was like they told us we weren't allowed to take pictures in there because they were like sort of trying to make it out like they were like these outlaws, or that they were like wanted by their government. And I was like, you're from Amsterdam. Like, I don't think you're that oppressed, but I could be wrong. You know, if a listener wants to like, write and correct me about that. But I was like, I think there's a little bit of over dramatization going on here. I think I could take your picture and go back to the United States and like show my friends a picture of you. And I'm not going to get you in trouble with your government, but okay. So just to say that everyone was super nice, and then they were going to be putting us up that night. Like again, like fucking Europe, man. They're like so nice there. They were going to be putting us up there, and like we knew that it was a squat, but we'd also heard that squats in Amsterdam were like nicer than like regular people's apartments in New York. So we were like kind of excited about it. And sure enough, we like get to this apartment, and it is a nice freaking apartment. That being said, so dirty. Like so dirty. Like it would have been such a nice apartment if someone had actually bothered to clean it. And we like, and there were just beds everywhere. Just so many beds. And like whoever the punk was that like I got to sleep in their bed, they just were like a crust punk and like really never bathed. And so like I like spent the whole night like hugging my teddy bear like so tight and like just dream. I was actually dream. You know when like you get input into your brain while you're asleep and then your brain just like puts it into your dreams? Yep. I swear to you, I was just dreaming about crust punks all night because like the odor was just like wafting up my nose, and it was just like the only image that would like come up in my dreams. And then we, you know, we wake up in the morning, we have to get back on a flight because the rest of our tour is like back in the UK. And so we're like halfway to the airport when I realize I have left my teddy bear in the squat. And I'm not leaving this city, and I'm not getting on another plane without my stuffed animal. My band was like, Hallie, you have to leave it. I was like, I'm not leaving. I threw my bass at them and I was like, I'll fucking find you at the airport. I'm going to get my fucking stuffed animal. And I sprint. And I was a runner back then. So I was like running. People were probably looking behind me to see who was chasing me. I was running through the streets of Amsterdam. I get back to the squat. There's no one there. I run to the venue. Someone at the venue knows someone who lives at the squat. They let me in. I grab the teddy bear. I pull the covers back and I swear his face is like, holy shit, girl, I thought you were gonna fucking leave me here. And I grab him and I sprint through the streets of Amsterdam. I get on the train. I find my fucking band at the airport and I get on the plane and I make it to the rest of our tour in UK, and it was, I've never felt so victorious in my entire life, and that's my story.
That teddy bear owes you a lot, Allie Bullen. I mean, wow.
Listen, I still have him. He's still sitting in a chair in my bedroom. That's my guy.
Hallie, can I say two things?
Yes.
One is that you fully made that right choice, being the non-narc, as a person who doesn't do drugs or alcohol. You made that right choice of bringing that teddy bear with you. Whatever you need, that was there. You're doing all right. All right. So, great
yes,
choice.
Thank you. That was the only way I stayed calm. And I was like, Charmin wouldn't let me die on this plane.
That's right. They'll take out whoever's going to try and light up a shoe or anything, you know? And the other thing I could think of is that I've also been to Amsterdam, and I could only think of the tram.
Oh, are you there?
Yeah, I think Chris cut out, but we'll call him back. In the meantime, Hallie Bullet, were your roommates mad, or do they think that was funny? I mean, not your roommates, your bandmates.
I mean, they were pretty pissed. I mean, they were so happy when I made it, but I think they felt like I was the shittiest bandmate, like, because I really could have missed the plane. They were like, are you serious? They were like, but I felt like if I left that fucking country without him, I was never going to see him again, and I wasn't not willing to take that chance.
Well, that's true. You probably wouldn't have seen him ever again, you know?
No, I couldn't do it. That's my homeboy.
Well, fair enough. That's a good tour story. We're going to jump over to M while we try to get Chris back online. M, what's your funny story?
All right. My mom works at a casino, and because she works at a casino, she's not allowed to go and gamble at other places that...
Really?
Yeah, so anything that the company she works for owns, she can't go and gamble at it because it's like a conflict of interest.
Oh, I
so,
see.
Yeah. So there's a spot that the company doesn't own that's an hour and a half or so away. So after I turned 19, we go there every so often, mainly just because they had a really, really good buffet. Like, it was just like great food. They had like beef and potatoes and like these pierogies, and the pierogies were the best things ever because they had pierogies with like bacon on the side, and then you could like mix them, and it was just so good. So I don't think that exists anymore, but it was really, really good. So like, we go, we'd eat, we'd walk around, and like, we gamble a bit, like nothing too bad, just like 10 or 20, you know, here or there at machines, you know, like just something for fun. So I've been told that I look young, so I always make sure to have my ID on me when I go anywhere where I would ever be asked. So when you go up to the entrance, before you're allowed to enter onto the gaming floor, there's a security guard, and he checks your ID and scans it to make sure that you're real and you don't have any exemptions that would bar you from entering the casino. So... you know, there is no...
What would bar someone from entering a casino? Like if you're over whatever age, why can't you go in there? Hallie, what, in the States, how old do you have to be getting a casino, 18 or 21?
I have no idea.
And, I mean, why couldn't you get into a casino if you were over 19 or whatever?
So if you have a gambling problem, you can bar yourself.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, welcome back.
Was it just me who dropped?
Yeah. Anyway, Em's telling a story. Go ahead, Em.
Oh, okay. So if you have a gambling problem, you can exempt yourself from, or you can bar yourself from a casino. So, you know, for however many days, they're supposed to not be allowed to let you in, but that's kind of bullshit. Like, they can let you in. Anyways, and then if you've had a problem with the casino before, they can be like, no, you're banned kind of thing. So that's just what they're checking for. That's mainly just to make sure that, you know, you are who you say you are. So, you know, like, there's no problem. So, you know, we go in and everything's all right. So there's two types of machines that always used to be lucky. So there are the Lucky Sevens, and there was a pirate-themed slot machine, and they were lucky because they had the actual, like, arm instead of the button. So, like, you could go and, like, you know, act like you're in, like, an old movie, and it was really, really cool. So they were really gross, like, looking back on it, but, like, it was really fun at the time. So I made my way to the Sevens, and at that point, a slot attendant noticed me, waved over a security guard who approached me and asked for my ID. So I showed them. Again, there wasn't a problem because it's real, and I passed the first test. So I put $10 in the machine, played for a few minutes, and I was on a bit of a roll, so I cashed out, met up with my family, we made our way to the buffet. So you pay before you go in. The cashier at the entrance also asked for my ID before I was allowed to go in. We went in, we sat down, we ordered non-alcoholic drinks. The server asked for my ID. Again, I have been in the casino for, I think, like, I don't know, at least an hour at this point. So again, like, they look at it, there's no problem. So we proceed to eat, and I ate an unadvisable amount of pierogies and bacon because they're the best. And I will never find pierogies like that. So after walking around on the floor for a few minutes, so we found the pirate machine, and we put in $20. So again, you know, like, we're doing pretty well, and it's all good. So after some time, we go to cash in our tickets at the, like, the machine where you put your tickets in so you don't have to deal with somebody to get the cash. And I notice that there's a security guard watching me. It's really obvious he's watching me, and it's really creepy. So my parents left. They went to the to go get something, and so I'm putting the money away, and, you know, like, I'm on my phone. The security guard waited until I was completely alone before coming over and asking for my ID. So at this point, this is the fifth time I have been carded.
Oh, no.
I have been in the casino for, I don't know, like, 3 hours. I have been around, you know, people. Anyways, so, like, again, he looks at it, nods, hands it back to me. It's clear I am not a child. I was 20 years old when this happened, you know. So I went there the day of my 19th birthday, and I only got carded twice. So at least we walked away with about $300. So that was good. But yeah, so that was my casino story.
Baby face.
Benjamin
and
Button.
And what's the secret to winning in a casino? Because I always lose. I mean, I don't go to the casino like that often. Oh. I always lose. How do you win $300 in a casino?
My theory is, I think if you're playing machines, they can sense your desperation. So if you're just like, I'm going to put, like, you know, $5 in, I'm going to put, like, an amount that I'm comfortable losing in, and I'm just going to play for fun, then you'll get more success. That's my theory. Yeah.
So the machines are vengeful in that the more you need the money, the less likely they are to give it to you, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Interesting take. Chris, speaking of vengeful, what's your funny story?
Oh, all right. Well, sorry I dropped in the call before, but here I am. All right. And hopefully no dropping during the story. All right. So I like Callie, we'll talk about a tour story. And so I'll put it this way. I was in a band in high school, and, you know, going into college, like, you know, you're trying to figure some things out. You're playing for a few years, you know, little dive bars or whatever. So one of my friend's band was starting to get more popular, and they wanted to take us out for a weekend. So I'm like, oh, okay, cool. That'd be awesome. You know, like, playing shows outside of the New York area. And, you know, going somewhere, you know, I've had a bunch of other friends that had done it. So I'm like, yeah, finally, it's my turn. And so we're supposed to play Philadelphia, Weston, West Virginia, and Virginia Beach. So I'll have to change, not necessarily change a few names, but maybe I'll omit some names so to protect identities. So, you know, we're loading up our, so it's like Friday through Sunday, and it's Easter weekend. So the Friday, you know, we're there, we're loading out. It's drive from Staten Island, where I grew up and where the studio was, to Philly, Staten Island, New York, to Philly, like, hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever. And this was 2005, mind you. So this wasn't quite, you know, way back when, because I'm not that old, but it was, you know, old enough where you didn't quite have smartphones and, you know, what do you call it? MapQuest was like your guide to everything. And, you know, it just wasn't what it is today. So we're packing up the van, and one of my friends come up and they're like, hey, bad news. The show we were supposed to play in Philly was a house party. The place got raided a few days ago, so we don't technically have a Philly show. I'm like, oh, shit. So they're like, but we're going to just drive there anyway, because the person who I will say is in a band that's blowing up in right now, so I won't name him. He was cool, though. Was like, oh, we'll meet up with him, and we'll try and find another show to jump on, right? And it's like, okay, fine. You know, we'll do that. We'll meet up with him. We'll go around. We'll see if we can jump on a show magically in 2005. Sure, that's going to work out well. So we go down. We get there. Hey, what's up? All right. You know, we go in. We go on a computer, looking up some shows happening in the area. We find out Flaming Tsunamis are playing just outside of Philadelphia. I forgot where. This is like pre me knowing anything about Philly. And we're like, okay, they're playing at this I can name the place in my area, but it's like a batting cage, like roller rink type deal, like an entertainment center for kids.
Oh, right? Outside of Philadelphia?
Yes.
You either mean Family Fun Spot or it's like Action USA or something. I know that.
I think it was, yeah, it's one of those two for sure. And so Flaming Tsunami, whichever one had shows, was having a show. And so we're like, okay, we're going to go. We'll just go. And it's us two in a van. We'll split a set. We'll just ask for a half hour. And, you know, because we're using the same equipment pretty much. And what's the worst that could happen? So we show up. And, of course, the people there are like, no.
Grand Slam USA.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, there you go. Of course not. No. Why would two bands show up and be like, hey, can we play a show? No. The answer is no. We close at 11. The show ends at 10:45. We have 15 minutes to clean up. No. Right? So we're like, all right, whatever. So we like hang out. We do a few things there. We go in the parking lot. We're hanging out in the van. My friend's band's popular enough at the time on MySpace where it's like, we could set up a table and maybe sell a few CDs. My band is nothing. So it's like, oh, yeah, check us out, whatever. So they sell a few CDs. They're like, oh, yeah, I heard you guys, blah, blah. Not me, my friend's band. And then said person who's supposed to help us get on the show is like, man, sorry, it didn't work out. He's a little drunk at this point. So we're like, all right, you know, it's all right, man. Thanks for helping us try. He's like, wait, hold on, I got a present for you. I'm like, whoa, what's going on? And he's just like standing next to the van, and he's clearly holding his anatomy. And he's like, wait one second. I'm like, nah, man, you can't piss on the van. It's a rental. It's a rental. So he pisses on the van. And we're like all sort of pissed off, but not. Other people were also a little drunk, got crazy in the parking lot. Police showed up. I'm like, get out. And we're like, bye. So we leave. And we go over to a hotel for the night. Then we, next day, we're on our way to West Virginia. I haven't even got to the crazy part of the story yet because it's a near-death experience, right? We played a Baxter pizza shop in West Virginia, right? People are like, what are you doing here? We're like, hey, we got booked for the show. Nice to meet you. Nice people. Great show. Had a ton of fun, right? This is where it gets funny. So now we have to get from West Virginia to Virginia Beach. Mind you, MapQuest though, okay? So I'm a directions freak. And if I'm lost for more than 10 minutes, I'm like, no, we can't do this. We need to know where we're going, especially the fact that we're in the middle of nowhere. So I remember there was supposed to be like an old 33 route somewhere in West Virginia. And I'm like, I don't see it. We're all saying we don't see it. So I'm like, let me out. I'll go in. I'll talk to somebody in a convenience store and I'll read a map and we'll figure it out. He's like, okay, fine, whatever. You got to go do your thing. So I go in the convenience store, gas station. This dude's like Santa Claus, but much skinnier. But just like if Santa Claus complete, right? So I go, hi there, howdy. I'm like, howdy, hi. Me and my friends are lost. We're trying to get to Virginia Beach. These are the directions that MapQuest printed up. Could you help us find Old 33? He's like, Old 33? Why would you go that way? Where are you going? And then I show where we're going. He's like, oh, I got a better way. And I remember exactly what he said. He took his 9.5 fingers and he pointed to the map. And he's like, you see this here? See, Route 219, 250, right? Go right over here. Go to Staunton, Virginia. See, look, you're going to go over this way? No. Why go that way? go 290-250 over Stoughton, Virginia. I'm like, okay, thank you so much. Someone else is at the counter is like, oh yeah, he's a bus driver. He's done it before. You can trust him. I'm like, okay, thanks. I get back in a van. I tell him exactly the same thing. It's Route 219, 250 Stoughton, Virginia. I'm like, all right, see how it goes, right? So now we have played the show that night. So it's already about 10 o'clock, something like that. And we're driving. It was a little bit of an earlier show, actually, but still, it was late enough. And we're driving. Okay. And now I'm in the front because, like, all right, you need to figure out the directions. You know, you're with the driver. Mind you, everyone in the van is, like, between 17 and 19, except the driver, who's 22, right? So we don't know our head from our ass. We're driving. All right. You know, it's getting late. We got to stop at a hotel at some point. Okay, no problem. Route starts going up. Okay. Goes up a little more. Okay. Then I realize we hit dense fog, two-lane road, no guardrail, and a 15-passenger van. And I'm just like, me and the driver are freaking out in front, like, holy shit, what's going on? And like, okay, just keep driving. Just drive slow. So we're freaking out for about a good 10 minutes. And then people start waking up because that's how long we had to be driving at that point. And they're like, oh, what's going on? They're like, what the fuck is going on? I'm like, we're in the clouds. We're in the clouds. There's two lanes. Okay. Nobody move. Nobody do something fucking stupid. They're like, oh, okay. And it was like a slow death roller coaster for about 2 hours. Like, when's it going to end? Not even the worst part. We get to a town finally. We're like, oh, we made it. Yes. Awesome. There's no lights in the town. The town is pitch black. And we're like, okay. So we send our 21-year-old out, right, to go check on the hotel situation. Comes back 5 minutes later. What happened? We're not staying here. Why? We just spent 2 hours in the mountains. Well, I had to pick up the phone, let it ring 3 times, hang up the phone. They had to let it ring 2 times. Then I had to pick it up and say a code word. Not happening. You're not oh, I'm like, there's one light in this town, and it's on the other side. We're like, well, we're going to have to chance it and see if there's something else on the other side. We go. We're on that main road. We don't want to drive off the road because, remember, it's 219, 250, so in Virginia, we don't want to get lost. There's nothing else to it. It was basically like a one-street town. We leave, and then it's like, oh, all right, we got to hit something soon. Back in the clouds, right? Back in the clouds, two lane. Again, no guardrails. Cars going around us and everything. We do that until 5:30 in the morning. Oof. And it's Easter Sunday at that point. It's like, okay, do we make it? We finally see a sign, welcome to Virginia. And at the end of that sign was a Days Inn. It's like, oh, God. Oh, we made it. We made it. We kiss the ground. We say, a hotel for two, please. And then approximately 9 people run into the hotel room. And we made it. Best part of that story, I said, I'm immortal. Nothing could happen to me. I came back from that tour with 101 degree fever. So, yeah. MapQuest, thank God you're gone. All right. Thank you, Waze.
Oh, the MapQuest tours. Yeah, those were dicey for sure.
Awful. Thank you for everybody's
Well, there you have it, Chris getting lost and coming back with a fever. Good story, Chris. Let's play a funny song. Here's one of my favorite funny songs that's not supposed to be funny, but it is. The Archies were actually a pretty cool bubblegum band from the 60s that weren't even really a band. It was actually some guy called Ron something. And he wrote songs that they played in the Archie cartoon. And there's one song called Scooby-Doo, which is clearly Archie singing about how he wants to have sex with Scooby-Doo. Listen to these lyrics. And this is from people are gonna think, oh, this is something from like the 2000s, the 90s. No, this is from the 60s, and it's written by the actual Archie. I mean, it's for the Archies, and it's clearly Archie singing about how he wants to have sex with Scooby-Doo. So this is the song Scooby-Doo by the Archies. Listen, and you decide.
So good. so good. Oh my. Could bring.
And now it's time to bring it down a little bit. Just like Greek theater, for every comedy, there has to be a tragedy. Let us roll the dice of destiny to see who goes in what order. First person, number one again. That's me again. I'm not loading it, but I did get number one again. Four, Hallie again. What the hell?
All right.
Then M, then Chris. Okay, slightly all different. Right. All right, so listen, here's my sad story. I had two sad stories that I flipped between. I decided to go with this one. So a couple of jobs ago, I used to work at a really good law firm with great people and a great firm and excellent, good firm, good people, but also good firm that they got great results. We represent a lot of nursing homes. And let me tell you, people, representing nursing homes is a bummer. It is a bummer. We represent nursing homes and everything except for personal injury. So we didn't do personal injury, but anything else, nursing homes is a bummer. And very quickly, the vast majority of nursing homes get paid through Medicare and Medicaid. Basically, if you're a citizen or even a permanent resident, your first roughly 20 days are paid for by the federal government at the nursing home. Then after that, hypothetically speaking, not everyone, but most people then have to deplete their assets till they have no assets. Then they're eligible for Medicaid, in which case the state pays for their stay at the nursing home. Except for super rich people or people have kind of done better financial planning, if you will. But it's a bummer. And honestly, not all nursing homes, but many nursing homes are very shitty. And meanwhile, like Hallie, what do you think it costs to stay at a nursing home? You're not even a nice one, like a crappy one per day.
Oh, I don't. You know what? I'm older, so my mom is getting older. I wish I should pay more attention to this stuff, but I have no idea.
$350, right? And so what happens is once you work your entire life, say your whole worth is $500,000, that's going to last you about 3 or 4 months at the nursing home. Your money's gone. Then the state pays for your stay at the nursing home, and then you get a tiny stipend, about $15 to $25 a month. And it's a bummer. It sucks. So anyways, the worst part about nursing homes is recently people within the past 10, 15 years, investors have been buying nursing homes that have no business running nursing homes. They're rented strictly for the money, which means they take already not great nursing homes and make them so much worse automatically. They have no nursing home experience. And honestly, you should not own nursing homes if you don't have tons and tons of nursing home experience, because it is a very difficult business and it's a bummer of a business. You know, no one likes doing it. Just people like making a lot of money, the people that do it. And you don't always make a lot of money. People lose money, but still. So there's this one dude that buys 115 nursing homes within a span of 2 years. He has no nursing home experience. I can't tell the listeners how insane that is, because you can't just buy a nursing home. You have to get licensed. You know, and Emma, what do you think a nursing home costs?
Like to run it?
To buy it.
Or just to buy it. $500,000?
$20 million, $50 million, $100 million.
Oh.
And, And this dude buys like 115 across like 12 states in 2 years. And he has no nursing home experience at all, right? And I have no idea how this passed, because you have to get licensed by the state. How are the states licensing this guy across 12 states? You know what I mean? And this guy's nursing homes, immediately they drop. They go real, they drop real low, right? The standard of care, that is, right? And so he gets way behind on his bills, and he starts shorting all these people money. He's not paying vendors. He's not paying employees. Chris, when you don't pay employees that work at a nursing home, that is the nurses and the staff and so forth, what do you think happens?
They walk out.
Right. And what happens when people walk out of a nursing home?
The people that need care don't get it.
Old people die, right?
Right.
So this dude is like bad news. This dude's bad news. And meanwhile, he's a super, super rich guy. You know what I mean?
Right.
Meanwhile, he's still collecting Medicare and Medicaid funds, that he's still taking federal funds and state funds, and he's not paying people. He's paying off old bills, or he's, you know, sending them overseas, which is what he's really doing. And so meanwhile, the states have to take all 115 nursing homes. The states take over all of them, right, which is almost unheard of, not completely unheard of. But for a state to take over a nursing home from a private owner is a big friggin' deal. And all 115 states divided by 12 states, every single nursing home got taken over, right? And look at it this way. Say 100 beds per nursing home times 115 beds. That's, 11,000 beds, right? Did I do my math right? Yeah, right?
Sounds about right, yeah.
Let's say 11,000 times $400, right? 11,000 times $400 would be $110,000, $4.4 million a day. Right?
Right.
What do you think this guy's office look like?
Oh, trash.
Single room place above a pizza parlor. That's his office. You know? So the state take over all these places, right? And so as part of my job, I got one of the best assignments that I could ever wish for. You know, because honestly, representing the nursing homes, I really started to hate the nursing homes. You know, I really did. You know, that's why I left the job. So they're like, John, we want you to hunt this guy down and file a civil suit against him for a lot of people, because he owes a lot of people money, you know? And I'm like, awesome, you know? But meanwhile, I'm thinking, how come no attorney generals are going after this guy? Like, this guy literally jeopardized hundreds and hundreds of old people's lives by committing fraud and stealing federal and state funds. And no attorney general, like, you would think an attorney general would be like, I'm going to put this guy in jail. This is going to be my reelection campaign for the next 16 years. Not a single attorney general went after him. I have no idea why. I really don't. You know, and you can Google this, and this is all, I mean, I'm holding back some details, but you can Google this and read all about this, right? And so I file a lawsuit against the guy. I get a judgment against him, a default, because he doesn't answer, because he's a dirtbag, right? Then I transfer the judgment to somewhere else where he's got assets. And the whole point is, I know none of his businesses. I mean, he's got a bunch of businesses. They're all shells. He's siphoning his money into his wife. He's siphoning his money into his kids. He's siphoning his money overseas, you know? But I'm like, I'm going to crack this MF-er. You know what I mean? So I get a private investigator to find his bank accounts. And I find a couple of bank accounts. And I garnish like 10 bank accounts. 9 out of 10, nothing's in them. Negative money, you know. One of them says, no, there's nothing in here. But I'm like, there's something weird about this sheet. So I call the bank back up. I'm like, what's the deal here? And they're like, let us send you a new one. And of course, there's a significant amount of cash in there, right? So I'm like, why did the bank tell me this guy had no money when he had a not a ton of – I mean, this guy owes millions and millions and millions to a lot of people, you know, and he should be in jail. And so I got that money, you know, after a lot of fight for – I mean, it's always hard to garnish a bank account from dirtbags, but this was particularly hard, right? So I'm like, well, listen, this guy's hiding his money. He's got no money left anywhere else. I'm gonna ride him like a hellhound, and I'm going to break his back. So what I would do is I would file motions for post-judgment discovery in a state where – so I've got judgments in two states. He lives in a third state. We'll just say the states are – they're not. But we'll say we'll say he lives in Vermont and the states are Maryland and Virginia, right? Well, actually, I don't know. I'm being weird about it. He lives in New York. I got judgments in Pennsylvania and New Jersey, right? So I file a motion for discovery in Pennsylvania, in the middle of Pennsylvania. Of course, he doesn't answer, you know. So I file a second motion. I'm like, he's in contempt of court. He didn't answer. And the judge's like, you know – Bill Smith, that's not his name. Bill Smith's got 30 days to answer this, you know. And I go back 30 days. Bill Smith didn't answer. They're like, we'll give him another 30 days. I'm like, all right. you know, 30 days. I'm like, Bill Smith didn't answer. Can I please have an order for contempt? He's like, sure. Bill Smith has to be here in 30 days, or we can send out an arrest warrant for him. It's very rare to get an arrest warrant in a civil case. So, of course, he finally does come because he's scared of getting arrested. He doesn't know that I can't arrest him in New York. I can only arrest him in Pennsylvania. So as long as he doesn't come to Pennsylvania, he's safe. But he comes to Pennsylvania, and his attorney's like, well, we want to do it in our office in New York. I'm like, nope. The judgment's in PA. I want to do it in PA. So I dragged this guy from New York down to PA. And let me tell you, this dude, he's a rich dude, but he's not a tough dude. Like, some rich guys are tough. And I don't mean physically. I mean mentally. This guy is not tough physically. He's not tough mentally. And he's like, so I see this guy, and he's not in good shape. He's sweating. He's huffing. He's like, I don't know why we couldn't just do this in my attorney's office. And he's trying to make me feel bad. And I'm thinking to myself, your suffering is giving me pleasure. Like, I don't know why you think – your whining would make me unhappy. I want you to cry. Like, I want to break you. You know, I'm just thinking that. So I do a deposition, and of course he lies all throughout the deposition. I'm like, well, how many employees do you have? He's like, I got no employees. You know, I'm like, you got no employees, and you got 150 nursing homes. Nope. You know. So I do the deposition, and I know he's lying. You know, and I'm going to act on his fake stuff, and then I'm going to bang him again and say, court, he's lying. Let's put him in jail. You know, and the idea is to put him in jail, not to put him in jail, to put him in jail to break him mentally. So he'll just say, fine, take whatever dollar so you get off my back, right? So meanwhile, I also do discovery in New Jersey, the same exact discovery because it's New Jersey. I filed him. He doesn't answer the New Jersey discovery. I drive all the way out to Jersey City. You know, I'm like, oh, Your Honor, he didn't answer my discovery. The judge said, we'll give him 30 days. I'm like, fine. I go back in 30 days. Your Honor, he didn't answer. We'll give him 30 days. I say, fine. I go back in 30 days. I say, Your Honor, he didn't answer. It's been 120 days. This guy's a bad guy. Help me out here. The judge's like, fine. We'll give him 30 days. And if he doesn't show up, then we'll issue an arrest warrant, you know. And then – so I go back in 30 days. No, the judge orders him to come in 30 days, like to actually be there. So the night before – so at this point, I had driven to Jersey City twice, and it is a long drive from where I was working. And so I'm like, well, I got to get up at like 3 a.m. to get to Jersey City. So instead of like having a bad night's sleep like I usually do, I'm not going to sleep too much the night before. I'm going to work out real hard, go to sleep at 8 o'clock, wake up at 3 a.m., zap up to Jersey City, beat the shit out of this guy. So I don't sleep too much the night before. I work out super hard.
Getting pumped up.
I stop. It's about
– break him like a boy.
It's about 9:30 p.m. I stop at Sheets to get like a drink. I look up at the screen. Gigantic snowstorm will be here in 2 hours. And I'm like, oh, my God. I cannot not show up in court after I've been hounding this guy for 120 days. You know what I mean? So I got no other choice but literally to – I'm exhausted. And this was very – I mean, it was dark. It's kind of raining. The snow is a half hour away, an hour away. I hop in my car. I drive from Harrisburg to Jersey City. And honestly – driving into Jersey City is very difficult. Like there's truck lanes and car lanes, and everyone's like, oh, well, you know, you can't drive. Listen, driving Jersey City is pretty difficult, especially not from Jersey City. So I can not see the snowstorm on my trail, but I know it's like 30 minutes behind me, and I am pumping down the freeway, like pumping to get there before the snowstorm. This is when I listen to a Johnny the whole way on repeat. I listen to Johnny Cash live in Madison Square Garden, and I listen to Maybelle Carter Cash sing Wildwood Flower probably 20 times in a row. That's how beautiful the song it was. And I'm like, I'm exhausted. It's dangerous for me to be driving. I shouldn't even be doing it. Like, if my mom heard I was doing this, she would be freaked out, you know. But I'm like, I gotta break this guy, you know. So I get to Jersey City while it's snowing. The snowstorm catches up to me. But if I'd been 20 minutes later, I would have had a real, real problem. But I get there. I check into a hotel at like 1 a.m. I wake up at 6 a.m. or 7 a.m. I get to the courthouse at 8 a.m. I go in. He's not there. I know he's not going to be there. And I'm like, all right, Your Honor, he's not here. Issue an arrest warrant so I can throw him in jail. And the judge's like, well, we'll wait till the end of the docket, till like 10 o'clock. And I'm like, why is the court giving this guy such a break? Like, why are they cutting this guy such a deal? Like, I really don't know why. Like, this, I'm getting no breaks, and this guy's getting all the breaks, and he's not even there. And one of the possible reasons is because judges hate to throw out arrest warrants for civil suits because you really aren't supposed – well, it's supposed to be a very extreme scenario, but this is a very extreme scenario, right? Mm-hmm. So at 10:29, I'm like, all right, Your Honor, just me and you. He's not here. Let me have my arrest warrant because I know he's terrified of arrest warrants. At 10:30 on the dot, the phone rings. He's coming in. You know, he'll be here in like 2 hours. I'm like, 9 o'clock is the time, Your Honor. And the judge's like, well, listen, I don't really want to issue an arrest warrant. I'm like, fine. We'll drag him out here. He'll lie again. And then I'll bang him in 30 days. You know, he gets out there and he's like, you know, Your Honor, it was snowing. And I'm thinking, mother effer, I literally was up all night and I drove here from a snowstorm. You live 15 minutes away. Literally, you know? And like I you know, so anyways, so I get the guy, just like, all right, go do your deposition, your post-judgment discovery. So I get him the thing, and of course, he lies again. He's got this janky-ass attorney, you know? And so I got him again. And so I'm like, all right, you can go. You know, I'll see. And I forgot. When he gets to court, he starts crying. It's a grown 65-year-old man crying. You know, and I'm loving this. I'm like I literally wanted him to have a heart attack. I wanted to kill him. You know what I mean? I wanted to break him. Like, I literally wanted him to have a nervous breakdown. I was literally trying to get him to commit suicide. Like, literally, you know. And the point being is, I'm loving this. And the point being is, you know, people say like, you know, hate is wrong. You shouldn't hate, you know, and you shouldn't hate. But I mean, I'm being 100% truthful here. Like, I have felt hatred in my heart. Like, hatred, you know. I wanted him to die. Like, literally, I wanted to kill him. I wanted to drag him stake to stake because I knew he wasn't a strong mental guy. You know, I knew he wasn't a strong physical guy. So I wanted to physically break him and give him so much stress that he offed himself or something. You know what I mean? Like, literally, and that's not a good thing, mind you. That's bad. You know, I think I'm a pretty nice person, but that's probably one of the darkest periods of my life. Like, I have hatred in me. Hatred, yeah. You know? And so I do the deposition, and he lies all up and down. And I want him to lie, mind you, because I want to get him in contempt and throw him in jail. And then I'll throw him in jail, and then I'll get access to whatever assets he hasn't, you know, tossed off to the other country. So I got him. I got him set up in PA. I got him set up in New Jersey. I got him lying all over the map because what he doesn't know is I've got documents that prove that he's lying, you know. And so I'm like, here we go. Oh, yeah. You know, so I file my motion for contempt in both states to throw him in jail and to get money out of him and, you know, also fine him for lying, which you're not supposed to do. What does he do? He disappears. He skips the country and never comes back, ever. So the point being is, this is a bad guy, you know, that made lots of money, that did everything wrong, that nothing bad happened to him at all. He made tons of money, skipped the country, put many people in danger. Maybe some people died. You know, and so people say, you know, karma, it'll all come back. I don't believe in that at all. I actually think evil people kind of have better luck. Maybe that's not true, but I kind of feel that way. But the point being is, I actually had to leave that job, not just because of him, just because of the general industry. The firm was great. The people was great. But I had hatred in my heart. And I don't know what it's like. I don't even know what it's like to walk around with hatred and you like literally have hatred in your heart, you know, and truly hate people, like hate people. And it does give you perspective, you know, when you say, oh, well, how can these people do this? Well, a lot of people that have hatred, it's wrong, but, you know, they're poor or they've been downtrodden or something like that. So you can sort of understand it. The point being is, I don't believe in karma. I think you should be good, because if people aren't good, then what is there? But also, everyone's human, and I don't know if I believe everyone's – well, everyone's human, but the vast majority of people that we think of that are rotten or hateful, you know, are usually poor people or people that don't have great circumstances, and you can understand their perspective. By contrast, guys like Trump, who have everything in their – or Steve Jobs – I'm not Steve Jobs. It was Steve Jobs. But Bezos, who have had every opportunity in their life and are still bad, they're the worst of all. You know what I mean? There's no excuse for that. But the fact being is, most people are human, and you should treat them that way. So that's my sad story. The bad guy won.
Oh, I forgot like halfway through that we were in the sad story segment, and I really believed that you were going to get this asshole.
I didn't get him. He's in another country.
Oh,
he's never
coming
back.
Oh, my God. It's so heavy to have like that kind of responsibility. Like my job's like the worst that would happen if I was bad at my job is that like an audience would be not entertained or like someone would like demand for their money back. Like it's so heavy to have that kind of responsibility on you.
Well, I love that
job like every day. It's a beautiful thing because you can really make a difference. But yeah, the frustration of not being able to nail someone that you know deserves it so badly, that would be hard. That would be really hard.
And the court kept giving him breaks. I honestly don't know why. The AGs didn't go after him. You would think the AG would be like, this is like a huge badge of honor to get this guy. You know, that's golden PR. I saved the old people. But none of them did anything, you know.
There's some money there somewhere
I can't say that just because I don't know, you know. But, I just think bad people kind of have good luck. But maybe not. I don't know. Hallie Bullitt, what's your sad story?
Okay, this is another tour story, but a sad one. So I do have to just set it up just to say that, like, you know, my band, The Unlovables, that was like my main band that I played in for like years and years. And it was like, it was not a huge band. But it was like, it meant, you know, I'm not trying to toot my own horn. It's just like, it did mean something to it, like a certain group of people. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think because we're all punks, like we know bands like that. Like right. We never were huge, but like we really meant something to like a group of people that was bigger than the group of people I ever thought would ever listen to my fucking music. And like, it was also really nice for me too, because my, you know, I was so lucky in that I did have a career in the theater. I did love my job, but my job was like to get on stage and wear a costume and say some words that somebody else wrote and to do some dance moves that somebody else choreographed. And like, The Unlovables was really just this incredibly beautiful project to me because it was just me. You know, it was like, if people liked it, it was me. If they didn't like it, it was because they didn't like what I did. You know what I mean? It was very personal to me. And like, it was so refreshing to be able to get up on stage and just like say shit that I thought, or, you know, like sing about my experiences. And so it just was this beautiful thing to me. And like, you know, we did it for a while. And then I got really busy with my other performing that was actually paying my bills. And so we stopped. We took like a 7 or 8 year break, and then we decided, you know what? Like, there's some nostalgia for this kind of music that we used to do, and like, what, you know? And we're nostalgic for it. And we were like, let's just like put it. We put out a split with another band, Dirt Bike Annie, that we had always played shows with, you know, back in the day. And so we put out this split, and we were gonna play Fest. And we did. We played Fest. It was like super, super, super fun. We had like had to like remember all these old songs and like hit the road again. And then we decided we were going to tour back from Fest. And our very last show on that tour was in Washington, D.C. on election night of 2016.
Oh.
And our set, you know, I think like when everyone tells the story of that election, everyone realizes like there was this point in the evening, like everyone thought that Hillary was going to win it. And then there was this point in the evening, and it happened rather quickly, where it was just like the cards just started falling very quickly in the wrong way. It was like just because of the way the Electoral College works. And, you know, it was just, she lost some key states, and it happened in kind of like a rapid succession. And it was like the mood in the country, at least for people that were Hillary supporters, it went from being like people were nervous, but feeling pretty confident going into it. And then it was like, it really just turned so, so quickly, and it became clear that she was losing the election. And that is when my band was on stage. That moment, my band was on stage playing. So, you know, the people that had showed up for the show, you know, I think, again, it's punk rock. So probably, you know, most people were really, you know, nervous that Trump might win. But I think if they came out to the show, they were probably, again, like feeling pretty confident. They probably just wanted to be distracted, and they just thought, well, you know, I'll go to this show, I'll have a good time, and I'll just look at my phone from time to time and just make sure things are like going okay, you know? And where we get on stage and we start playing, and it was like the first person that I noticed was like a dear friend of mine that had shown up to the show. He like looked at his phone, and you guys, he just like never looked up from his phone again for the duration of the set. And like, I, you know, it was like my friend was the first person I noticed, but then I noticed it was just like, it was like this wave that went across the crowd. It was like people went from like watching us and enjoying the show to just like, just one by one, you'd see people pick up their phone, and then they would just stare in horror at their phone while we're still just like up there trying to play these dumb pop punk songs. Like, and I really thought there had maybe been another terrorist attack or something. Like, I thought something, it was like, I don't know if I was just naive about the election, or if I just, it was really hard for me to conceive in that moment of what was actually happening, but I knew something was terribly, terribly wrong. And we finished out our set, and we like got off stage, and our tour mate, Emmeline Brodsky, was like the first person that met us when we got off stage, and she was just in tears. And she was like, he won the election. She's just like bawling. And I just like, it was like, I just had entered this, like, I mean, I think everyone remembers that moment, what that moment was for them, but it was like, I had just entered this like fucking Twilight Zone, like dystopian universe, like horror show. And we, you know, we had a place to stay in Philly that night. We got in the van. We cried the entire way to Philly. I remember at one point we had to stop for like gas, and we were in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania had been like, you know, you remember it had been like a very key state that Hillary had lost and that Trump had won. It had really it that had like dealt a real death blow to her that she had not won in Pennsylvania. So we go to get out and like get gas in Pennsylvania. I swear I was like looking at every single person in the gas station, like, you, was it you? Was it you? Like, I felt like I was like in enemy territory. I was like, you traitors, how could you? Like, how could you do this to us? And it's just like, you know, it's just super sad to me. Not, you know, yes, because of the politics of it, but just on a personal level, it is really probably, that is probably the last time the Unlovables will ever have played. And this like project that I poured like so much of my heart into, it's like to have that be our last show and like the last moment that I remember being on stage, like singing those songs to people. It is like really like one of the sadder things of my life. You know what I mean? It's like so sad, you know, not in a way that I'm going to like weep about it, but I just like every time I think about it, I'm like, oh, that is just such a shame. That's just so not how it should have been, you know, although, you know, we were the Unlovables. So maybe that's exactly how it should have been. Maybe we were destined to have an incredibly like bad luck, Unlovable last show. But that's my sad and poignant story.
It's a rough final. You know, final shows are either like wonderfully like explosive, like bands like fist fight on stage, or it's like this wonderful like big, you know, final shindig. And for you guys, it's just like depressing. That sucks.
Oh my god, wait. So speaking of that, the hissy fits. I was no longer in the band, but their last show, they got in a fight on stage. The drummer threw her, and she pushed her entire drum kit over at the singer. They all chased each other around the bar, and I don't remember exactly how it happened, but the singer ended up with a broken arm by the end of the night.
Oh my last god!
Now that's how you break up.
Exactly. That's the last show.
Oh man! And more. Make us weep some more.
Oh. Okay. So. When I was younger, I lost two very close family members over the span of about 2 years. So at the time, it seemed like everyone around me got over their sadness and like all their emotions very, very quickly, and that I was expected to do that too. So I felt like something was wrong with me because I was still like very sad and extremely angry over what had happened. So after the passing of my second family member, so I was about 11 or 12, we had to clean their house and put it up for sale. So, like, that was over the summer. So it was, like, every day kind of from, I don't know, like 10 in the morning to, like, 5 or 6. And they had a lot of stuff. And they're a smoker, so we're, like, Lysoling the walls and everything. So it was really tough, like going there every day and being confronted with all these memories and basically erasing these people. That's what it felt like. So what I was listening to at the time, which was like there was like a little bit of Green Day, but it was mainly like pop and stuff, wasn't helping me and was just making me feel worse. So at the time, I happened to be reading a book that mentioned punk music and especially the Sex Pistols quite often. So at that point in my life, the only band that would be classified as punk that I had actually heard before was Green Day. And the first time I heard them was in the car on the radio. And again, what I would do is if I heard a song I liked on the radio is I would memorize every single, like, everything I could about it because I didn't know when I'd hear it again. So you know, like, I didn't associate Green Day with punk at that point, because it's like, oh, they're a radio band, they're cool. So, but, like, I needed something way more at that point. So, I needed an escape, I needed an outlet, I needed, like, literally anything. So, I think roughly two years before, for my birthday, my parents bought me an iPod, and I still have it, and it still works, and it's the best thing. So I went out and I bought Nevermind the Bollocks, Here's the Sex Pistols without ever hearing them, on iTunes, and I listened to it obsessively over that summer. Like, I memorized all the words, I memorized everything, like the track order. Like, there were certain songs like I skipped, and certain songs I didn't, and then I came back to them, and it was just, so, like, the energy, like, the vocals, the sneering, the anger, like, everything, they're exactly what I needed. It got me through the summer, and it marked the point, so this marks the point where I fully began, like, getting into punk and punk music and everything. So, like, I was from the Sex Pistols, I was discovering, like, different, like, mainly older bands, and, like, looking more into, like, Green Day's older stuff as well. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I truly belonged and connected to something that wasn't myself or my family, that was outside of myself, and helped me kind of build my own identity and who I am today. So, yeah. Then when John Lydon came out and, you know, kind of was a tool bag, that really, it hit me hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that really bothered me, because, again, that the band and everything, like, it meant so much to me at that point in time. So now it's kind of like, so that's my story.
Oh my God, Nevermind the Bollocks was my gateway punk album as well. And it just, like, yeah. I read that really, oh my gosh, that really hit me when you said that, because I just, like, could picture myself in the room that I lived in at that time, just, like, devouring that album. And yeah, I love that that was the start of it all for you too. That was a beautiful story, Em.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. We're glad, although it's not totally the saddest of stories, because even though you know, he who go unnamed right now ended up being a total tool bag, you're here because you had that gateway album. So in a way, it's a win. He takes the L, but you get the win in the end. All right.
Mm-hmm. No, for sure. Yeah. Only good things.
Yeah, only good things. All right.
Well put, Chris. Well put indeed. So, Chris, why don't you put your sad story well, and then we'll be able to get out of this weepiness bog, and we'll get to some wackiness. But go ahead, Chris. What is your sad story?
Well, full disclosure, my saddest stories, I can't share all of them publicly because that's too heavy. But I'll share a personal setback that just absolutely, like, at the time, like, crushed me. And, I mean, so there – yeah, I'll put it that way. So what happened was that – I'm finishing college and, you know, I'm thinking about what I want to do, like, getting out of college. And, you know, while studying in college, I'm like, oh, I know a lot about political science, blah, blah, and whatever, and debating with people. I'm like, I'll be a professor. I had a lot of anxiety stressing and finishing college and balancing a bunch of things. And I'm like, you know what? I don't know if I want to get involved in academia. There's a lot to it. I don't know if I can emotionally handle it. So I'm like, you know what? At various points throughout my life, I'm like, you know what? I'll become a teacher and stuff like that. So I'm like, I moved out. I'm earning, like, you know, no money, like, getting my first out of college job that was full time. I had a job that I earned more in college than after college, if that makes sense. And it was mostly because I didn't want to work nights anymore. So I'm like, all right, I'll do a daytime job with an education. And it was, like, kind of like up and down. And then I got it out to go into college admissions, and I won't name the college, obviously, for reasons. And I became disillusioned with it because I wasn't getting a lot of money. The college I was selling, you know, I don't really want to disparage it too much. It's just mostly the fact of it was sold to a certain demographic, and they wanted to sell it to another demographic that was never going to be interested in it. And it's just like, get high school students. It's like, they don't want to come here. You know, we're more continuing ed. So it's just like, they weren't playing to their strengths. And it was the constant battle that I kind of had to deal with. So after like being there 2 years earning crap and, you know, being the most important person in the off, you know, and bringing people in, like we need people to bring people in. It's like, we're not selling anything good here. You know, we're only selling what people, you know, need, and the people that need already know to come in. So there's not much I could do to sell them. The only thing I could do is just help them come in. I was kind of frustrated and disillusioned, but I decided to start taking classes to get to where I'm at. And so I took some extra continuing ed classes, you know, it's like 12 credits. And I'm like, okay, you know, I think I could self-certify to become a teacher now. And then I go down to the board and I start talking, and I'm like, oh, that deadline changed now. So sorry, can't self-certify. You actually have to go into a master's program. And I'm like, oh, all right, fine. So that's it. We're not even there yet. So still on the setback part. So now we're still going to go down. I'm like, all right, whatever. You know, I'm going to start this, but I'm going to have to find a way to get in to what I'm going to do. But I'm going to have to eventually, like, I'm starting to emotionally check out from this job. Like, I'm at every, like, meeting every month, like, this is garbage, this is garbage, this is not working, and whatever. And, you know, I have connection with my New York City Department of Education. And for years, they were not hiring many people because of budget cuts and stuff like that. So eventually they're like, oh, finally, yes, we have a substitute. We have substitute positions coming in, classroom assistant, not a glamorous job, but, you know, it's something that you can kind of in with. It's like, all right, great. Yeah. All right. Got a principal. Give me a letter. You know, bring us down, go into the bureaucratic hole known as the New York City Department of Education. And, you know, wait for your phone call. It's like, okay. I think I did that in February, and it was like February of 2013, something like that. So I'm like, all right, I'm really checked out. I'm like, all right, can't wait for this call. Can't wait for this call. But I'm like, I know it takes time. So I wait a month. I wait 2 months, you know, and then I'm talking to like family members, like, did you get the call yet? I'm like, no. I'm like, oh, that's a little weird. It's taking a little long. Call the guy who had wrote the letter. Trust me, they're going to call you. Don't worry. It's going to happen. May comes around. Now, there's a positive sandwich in this because it involves punk. I go to Pooza Fest in Montreal. I go, I have a grand time at Pooza Fest. I'm like, woo, whatever, you know. Great time, right? I come back into the U.S., right? And I'm driving near the Adirondack Mountains, and I get a call, and it's from a school. Like, hey, could you come in? I'm like, that's cool, except I didn't get a call from the central yet to get processed. And they're like, oh, you're not processed yet? And I'm like, no, no one ever called me. They're like, oh, that's funny. All right, well, we were hoping you could come in. I'm like, all right, well, I'll follow up, and hopefully, you know, someone's out again soon and I could come in. So I finally call up, like I get every number that I can to call central, whatever. I'm calling up, and like, ah, yes. Ah, okay, yes, I see you right here. I'm like, yes, you know, I've been waiting for 3 months now, three and a half months. Yeah, we tried emailing you. What do you mean? Well, yeah, we tried emailing you. You didn't respond to our email. What email do you have on file? And they're like, and they read my old DOE email, which I thought was deactivated because I left the job several years before. And they're like, we emailed you there. And I'm like, no one told me. They're like, yeah. Well, that's where we emailed you. And I'm like, okay, well, what can I do to process this now? And they're like, nothing. We're done for the year in terms of getting new subs into the system.
Oh, my God.
Stop.
And I'm like, what? Wait, what? And they're like, yeah, no, I'm really sorry about that. And I think I had about a 5-minute, like, emotional, like, screaming fit in the car. Because I'm like, I'm on a break from the job that I'm at. And I'm like screaming, I'm fucking done with this. I got to, like, everything under the sun that's just like pissed off and unholy. And I'm just like letting it out. So someone's coming by the car looking at me. They're like, what's up with this dude? This dude wasn't having it that day. Because it's just like, hurry up and wait. And I waited. It's like, but we tried to call you. And it's like, that set me back about a good few months before I eventually had to go another path to get to where I was. So, I mean, a good thing, there is a good ending, and I am where I am now. Like, I did eventually, you know, get in, get my job or whatever. But that just, like, that next about 4 or 5 weeks was just, I was absolutely surly and like talking to nobody at my job at that point. And then the only good kind of thing at the end of it was I go to my master's committee and they're like, yeah, you got to get in the classroom. And I'm like, well, I can't, because I honestly tried to get some type of sub job and it didn't work out between you and me. I don't want to tell my admissions department. They're like, oh, all right. Well, if you want to avoid this certain test, you might want to get in the classroom this summer. So I actually ended up having to quit my job in order to finish what I had to do for my career. So did end up being well and ended up being okay. But it was just like that personal setback. Like, I remember like that emotion very vividly, getting that call like, no, we tried to contact you. It's like, I'm amazed my car steering wheel worked after that. Oh. That's how much I had now in the car.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Well, man. Listen, Chris. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chris.
No. That's pretty much it. I mean,
well, it's a testament to you. It's a testament to you that you persevered. You know what I mean? And that's the lesson to take from it is, you know, some people have an easy life and everything's, you know, easy. And most of us just got to fight through it. And Chris, kudos to you for fighting through it. You know what I mean?
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Well, here's the saddest song I could think of. Watching Scotty Die by the Dead Milkmen, a mildly funny but deeply depressing and sad song. Here we go. Listen, people, let's light it up with some pure weirdness. The Dice of Destiny gets one final spin. We're going long. But, Emor, can you hang in there for one more segment?
Yeah, let's go.
Hallie Blick, can you hang in there for one more segment?
Let's do it.
Chris Barrett, can you hang in there for one more segment?
Sure.
Let us roll the Dice of Destiny and see who goes first. 2. Who's that?
Oh, I think that's me.
M goes first. Then.
Oh, okay.
Then. 2 again. That's it. 3. That's Chris.
Yep.
Then 1, me, and then Hallie Bullitt caps us off. And more, kick us off with your weird story.
Okay. So I was working on one of them like kind of yesterday into today, and then I thought of another one. So the other one's kind of like paranormal, so maybe we can do like a spooky story episode or something.
Yes.
So
We are doing that.
So I'm gonna save that one, and so I'll go with the one that I was working on before. So a year after I graduated high school, I did something that I never thought I would do. So I applied for university. I got in. I applied for student loans. I got them. I'm still paying them off, and they won't be fully paid off for like something ridiculous, like 10 years. And I moved to Toronto. So I was very excited because I'd always wanted to live in Toronto. I'm from a very small town, so it would be, you know, I always want to be somewhere, you know, that's very full of energy and just kind of see what a city's like. But I was also, like, pretty on edge because the year I went, the Yonge Street van attack, which killed 10 and injured 16, had happened that April. And the Danforth shooting, which killed 2 and injured 13, had happened that July. And it happened roughly a month before I was set to move into my residence building. Mm-hmm. So, I had to be very alert, very aware, and my parents were kind of, you know, freaking me out a little bit about stuff too. But like, again, that's being alert and aware was like nothing really new. Because when I was in high school, there was a person or a group of people who tried to burn down the school pretty much every year. So they succeeded one year in setting a fire, and it caused the school to be evacuated. So in all these cases, we were not informed about what was going on. Like, stairs would be closed off. We could smell gas and yada, yada. And we found out on the local news, where the stories only warranted like about a minute or so of airtime. So the university ended up going to, it's located in the heart of downtown Toronto and had a security policy that whenever an incident of whatever nature was reported, an email was sent out to the staff and students informing them of what had occurred and where it happened. So it was a nice change of pace to like be in the loop and actually know what's going on around you, instead of just kind of having to kind of figure it out. So yeah, like the security incidents, they ranged from like physical assaults to like voyeurism. Like, there's quite a few of like people trying to watch people pee between cracks in bathroom stalls, and like indecent acts, and public masturbation was a really big one. So there was a good chunk of time we're getting an email about public masturbation a day. And all of these emails contained descriptions of the person, and there were quite a few where it was the same person, the same description. So we thought it was a serial masturbator. So we're kind of like, oh, what if we see this person? So like just an example of like the security incident, like it just read, a community member reported to security that they noticed an individual masturbating. The community member declined assistance from Toronto Police Service. So at the height of this, I was walking back through the Eaton Center. I had food. A nicely dressed older man approached me and started talking to me. So my first thought was that he like possibly fit the description of the serial masturbator. And I really half expected him to like whip it out and just like start going at it. He didn't. So I pretended to see somebody I knew and just like got out of there. So in hindsight, I think he was just like a creep trying to hit on young women, because he said, oh, I could, I'm old enough to be your dad, which is
how old are we gross. Talking? Are we talking like 40? Are we talking like 70? Are we talking about like 100? What are we talking here?
I think it was about 65 to 70.
All right, ooh. All right. Because I was thinking, Em's like an older man. I'm like, how old? She's like 37. I'm like, oh god,
old enough.
Go ahead, Em.
Like elderly.
Oh man.
So later that night, I was with my friend and we were walking back from class later in the evening when we saw a man who was described we saw a man who looked like the man who was described in the emails, wrestling the eel, shall we say. And we saw another person later that night sitting outside of our residence building, really just going at it. So these two incidents, like, we didn't report them or anything, but after, like, the frenzy of masturbation emails, they really went down, and we went back to getting stuff like this, which is one of the weirdest security incidents we've ever had. And it's a community member reported to security that an individual used their hand to drip urine on them from above while they were inside a washroom stall. So I no longer go to this school. I had to drop out, but the year in a bit I was there is very eventful.
Oh my god,
what's in the air? Like, is it something like, oh man, it's just the humidity tonight, it's just going. What?
I think, like, the person who, like, it ended up being about was a student or something. Like, there is some, like, connection. Oh. Yeah.
Man, it's just like a side effect of a hit or something. It's like, wow. Oh boy. I'm sorry.
Oh. Go ahead. Chris, it's your turn. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm about to say, I don't know how to segue. I didn't expect that. I do love the wrestling the eel kind of. That was awesome. That is now a term I'm going to use. Wrestle the eel. Awesome. All right, so my weird story involves punk, which is cool, and involves a trip, which I love to involve as well. So my first foray to Europe with my wife Sam, who everybody knows because Sam does a bunch of things for Punk News, or Sammy's. We went to Paris, and so we're like, yeah, I'm all excited, like, you know, going to Paris or whatever. And it turns out that there was a show, I think was this is where it kind of blurs, if it was the same night or the next night from when we landed. I think it was the same night actually when we got to Paris. And we have a weird like streak of sometimes taking trips where there's like a show that night. So it happened to us in California and a few other places, but so now we're in a foreign country. It's like, whoa, okay, yeah, okay, sure. So we get to Paris. Like, I think we took a nap because we were jet lagged, all messed up and whatever, and, you know, trying to check things out, whatever. Like, okay, so we're going to have to figure out this whole subway system, stuff like that. We're going to get down to the show. And it turns out, I don't know any, hopefully some listeners or whatever, correct me if I'm wrong, whatever, but there's a venue on the Seine River called Petit Bain. I don't know how to say it, so whoever is listening is probably shouting at the computer, you're saying it wrong, so sorry. But it is, yeah, Sam keeps saying it's a boat. It wasn't a boat, it was a floating venue, which is still weird enough. Now mind you, when we went to Paris, it was less than a year after the Bataclan incident, you know, with the attacks and everything. So This is 2016, you know, that incident happened in 2015, so keep that in mind for later in the story. So we're, you know, oh, okay, cool, by the Seine River, taking selfies or whatever. And it's like, oh, we're there early. And it was Comeback Kid, Defeater, No Warning. And I honestly, sorry if I'm disrespecting the first band, I don't remember who you were, the first band. But I know that the first two bands kind of had like a following. And this is like USA, New York City, hardcore brain in my head. I'm like, I don't know if I really want to be there for that type of pit. So I'm like, you know, like, we're in France. We're by the Seine. There's a bunch of, like, people eating charcuterie on a board and, you know, drinking wine and beer by the river. It's like, let's just hang out, you know, for the first two bands. And they put the set times up. And, of course, 24-hour format, of course. So we had to do translation in our head. And, like, yeah, we'll go get, like, a soda and a donut. Like, you know, typical people who are going to punk shows do or whatever. So we hang out by the Seine. We have a snack. We're relaxing. I'm not really, you know. Sun setting later because it's a weird time over there in France at the time. And I'm like, all right, about time. We got to get in, try and get a spot. I don't know how shows work out here, but let's figure it out. So we go in, you know, venue's downstairs. It's nice, a little dark. All right, whatever, you know, punk, whatever. And Defeater starts to play. And, you know, so now we're not dealing with, you know, people of the public. We're dealing with punks and whatever. And before Defeater's playing, the venue's only playing pop music in between sets. And I mean, when they were playing pop music, it was like an actual rave. People are singing to every song. And these are like, you know, global pop hits, like, you know, English, global English pop hits. So that was my first experience with that. And it's just like all into it. I'm like, whoa, they're not just having a normal conversation in between, you know, trying to shout at each other over the whatever. They're like really into whatever music they're playing right now. Okay, cool. So then Defeater plays. A bunch of people are just screaming every Defeater lyric at them. Yeah, 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 yeah. Play the Red, White, and Blues. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, and the pit was really cool because, like, you know, Defeater's kind of more of a hardcore band. And, you know, so I'm expecting, like, just, you know, typical, like, points where there's beatdowns and stuff. But, you know, people get knocked down, people picking them right back up. People who look like punks don't look like punks in the pit. It was like, man, I haven't been to a show like this in years, and it wasn't this type of band that was playing, right? So here's where it gets weird. Middle of one song, and I'm actually more of a Defeater fan now. At the time, I wasn't quite, but I still don't even remember what song it was. And they're just playing, and they're just playing, and they're just playing. And then all of a sudden, everything goes black. Everything shuts off. And my immediate thought was Bada Klan. And I'm like, holy shit, I'm going to die. Like, immediately, once everything went off, I'm like, oh my God, we're going to die. And then the drummer was still playing the song. So it took about 5 seconds for everyone to react to the fact that everything had shut off. And they're like, wait, the drummer's still playing. They finished the song. The crowd began screaming the lyrics to the stage and finished the song with the drummer, which is a good 30 seconds. Now, I mean, it's more of a happy story, but it was more of the fact that I can't believe that everyone in their second language finished the song in the middle of a blackout on a floating venue. And it was just like, as weird as it was one of the most beautiful things I ever experienced. Definitely top five show I ever been to, even though I didn't like every band on that bill. So that was great. Shout out to everybody, you know, at that show of French punks or whatever, if you're listening or whatever, probably not, but still, that was fucking awesome. There's no way that's never going to be replicated, like ever. That I could think of, like, just total blackout, foreign, whatever, people screaming the end of that. So go to a show overseas and experience something different.
That sounds like so trippy and so beautiful. That's awesome.
I mean, I've heard amazing things about, you know, Europeans and like bands touring Europe and stuff like that. I'm sure Hallie, you have stories as well. I mean, if there's one thing, you know, any basis for hire, you know, I have offers. Don't scream lyrics at me. But yeah, all right, John. Oh, I'm sorry, who's next?
I think next. It's John.
Oh, it was John. I was right. All right, I was paying attention.
That's a good story, Chris, and you know, a real cool, like, a concert kind of thing. Here's my story that has no big moral. I feel like my other two stories, like, had morals. Maybe this one's gotten, it's just a weird weekend that I had. So last Punk Rock Bowling was one of the best times that I ever had in my life. I saw I saw Black of the Dwarves. I saw Flag. I saw Sloppy Seconds. I saw Coat Hangers. I saw the Drugettes. I saw World Inferno. I saw I saw Brad and Sturgeon Leftover Crack. I saw so many awesome bands, right? I actually left a day early because I was flying out to Paonia, Colorado. He said, John, where's Paonia, Colorado? Paonia, Colorado is in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere. And the reason I'm flying out is because about 6 weeks before that, I used to go out with a girl. We'll just say her name was Julie, but that wasn't her name. And she was real cool. And she dumped me a while. I mean, it wasn't like anything bad or anything. She dumped me, honestly, because she ran with a little bit wilder crowd than I did. And I wasn't – I mean, like, you know, it's like back then it'd be like, your friends do cocaine? And now I'd be like, oh, that's cute. Your friends do cocaine. I just wrote a book about a band of five guys. Four of them were severe heroin addicts. Some of them still are heroin addicts. Some of them still do smoke crack. Some of them have severe mental health issues. Yeah, cocaine, real cute. How corny, you know what I mean? Now I'd be like, all right, you know, all right, Mr. Big Shot, you know, you did cocaine, all right, you know, like, fuck you, you know. Anyways, but, you know, back then I wasn't quite as hip to the ways of the world, you know what I mean? So she dumped me, but it was, I mean, it wasn't like ugly, it wasn't an ugly thing. It was just like, you know, it's like, you know, and she was real cool. And I think she liked me. I just wasn't. I was a little bit more of a square guy, you know, whatever. So anyway, I talked to her here and there, and then maybe about a year before Punk Rock Bowling, we started talking a little bit, and then about, you know, 6 months before Punk Rock Bowling, she's like, I'm out in Paonia, you know, if you ever want to come out and relax, let me know. And I'm like, oh yeah, I mean that'll be cool. So I'm like, well, you know, I'm gonna be Punk Rock Bowling in 6 months. I can leave and, you know, fly out to Paonia if you want to hang out. And she's like, yeah, that'll be awesome. I'm like, all right, that's cool, you know. And let me be clear, I wasn't expecting anything flying out except for a good time, not even holding hands. You know what I mean? Like literally, I'm just going out and we'll see what, you know, we'll see if we have a nice time. I know I'm not a Mr. Fabio or whatever, you know, or a suave, but we'll fly and we'll have a good time. You know, we'll see what happens. You know what I mean? Like no pressure, no expectations at all. Cause you know, and so I'm at Punk Rock Bowling. Oh, meanwhile, before I go to Punk Rock Bowling, I'm like, oh yeah, so I'm going to be there, you know, in about 7 or 8 days. I mean, is everything still cool? Or, you know, if you got something going on, that's cool. I can change my plane. You know, that's not a problem. I can go to LA and hang out. She's like, no, come on out. I'm like, oh yeah, sounds cool. So I forget the Punk Rock Bowling. I'm having the best time of my life. Not the best time, but one of the best times of my life. Fantastic, you know. And while I'm at Punk Rock Bowling, like, oh yeah, Punk Rock Bowling is pretty rad. You know, I'm going to fly in about 3 days. It's still cool if I come out. Cause you know, if you got something going on, that's cool. You know, I get it. You know, she's like, no, come on out. You know, I'm giving this girl every easy out I can give her. I'm a big fan of giving people easy outs. You know, I gave her 4 easy outs over the span of about 6 weeks. You know, she didn't take any of them, right? So I fly out. Where you got to get to Paonia, you got to fly into Aspen. I always thought Aspen was like this giant place with all these ski resorts. Aspen is like a shithole in the middle of nowhere. Aspen sucks ass. You know what I mean? Like Aspen sucks. You know, there's like nothing there. You know? So I'm like, this is Aspen? So anyways, I get some van, and so it's like a 3-hour drive to get to Paonia. And I, you know, I'm driving over mountains, and I'm driving up mountains, I'm driving down mountains. I'm pretty sure I saw a moose or something, you know. And it's the kind of mountains that curve all around. There's no guardrail, so you don't want to be.
Oh, I know.
You don't want to be slinging along like circle jerks, and you're like, you know, behind the door, and you go right over the mountain, and that's the last people ever hear you. You know what I mean? Like you got to focus, you know. So I'm driving about an hour and a half. I'll be there about. She's like, oh, I just got a job interview, so I'm gonna be an hour later than usual. I'm like, that's fine, that's cool, you know, whatever, you know. So I get to Paonia and I get there, and Paonia is not even a one horse town. It's like a one miniature donkey town. Like there is the square is like 2 streets, you know. And I mean, it is in the middle of nowhere. Like, no, I can't explain how in the middle. There's one gas station, you know, and there, you know, there's one post office. There's one, like, strip that's got, like, 4 shops. There's one grocery store. There's one Subway and a bakery. And that's the whole place. You know what I mean? And then I go to the gas station. I'm like, well, she's not going to be here for an hour. So, I'll go to this one, like so Paonia's a weird place in that it's – I hate to use the word rednecks because I don't mean – like demean people, but it's rednecks and some hippies, you know what I mean? And she's kind of more on the hippie side, you know what I mean? It's like it's a weird town, and by town I mean like not that many people at all, you know. So I go to the honey store, you know, which is like it's really a camping, like where you bring your RV and you camp, but I got nothing to do for an hour, you know what I mean? So I'm looking at the honey store, and they got like 5 honeys in there. I'm like looking at the honey, I'm like, that's honey, you know. So she texts me and she's like, oh, I'm running a little late, you know, I'll be there in a little while. So I'm like, all right, that's fine. So I'm like sitting in my car, I'm playing Yahtzee on my phone for like 2 hours in the camping lot, you know what I mean? Finally, she's like, I'll be there in 45 minutes. I'm like, oh, that's cool, you know what I mean? So she's like, I'll meet you in front of the grocery store. I'm like, that's cool. So I go to the grocery store, she shows up, you know, she's looking good, and she runs up, she hugs me, she's like, oh, it's so great to see you. I'm like, yeah, this is cool. So she's like, sorry, I'm late. I had to go to therapy and I had a job interview. And I'm like, all right, you know, that's kind of weird. You know, things like aren't meshing, you know what I mean? Like, all right. I'm thinking, I flew all the way out from Las Vegas and drove 3.5 hours to be here. But, you know, whatever, you listen, you know. So then we drive to her house. She lives in a house with like 4 dudes. And the dudes are all homosexual men except for one guy. And I'm not trying to be a dick. There are stereotypical ways. He's an effeminate guy. How do I say it? He's an effeminate guy, but he's not
gay. The term used to be metrosexual. That used to be the term.
No, but beyond that, like almost like he's putting on an act. You know what I mean? Okay. But so I'm thinking, like it was some kind of like commune for gay men that she lived at, which I didn't fully understand, and I still don't understand, you know. But, like, they had, like, chickens there and stuff. I'm like, I mean, they were all very nice. Like, no one was a dick to me there. But the one guy who acted, I guess, the most, quote, effeminate, or however you want to phrase it, he's, like, acting super feminine, and he's, like, speaking with a lisp and stuff, which some people have lisp and some people, you know. But he keeps talking about his wife. I'm like, well, why are you living here if you've got a wife? He's like, yeah, my wife and I are going on vacation in 3 weeks. I'm like, why are you living? I couldn't figure out. But I'm like, I'm playing it cool. You know what I mean? I'm like, yo, that's cool, man. That's cool. Like, I'm the guest. You know, I'm trying to be Mr. Chill. You know what I mean? And so she's like, so as soon as we get, she's like, you know, my friends meet up for a weekly soccer game. I'm going to go play soccer. You want to come play soccer with us? And I'm like terrible at soccer, like really, really bad. And I'm like, well, I'm like, you know, I just was a long drive. I took a flight and then I drove. I'll just sit and relax and watch. And so she starts playing soccer with the guys and some other guys that showed up. And they're all like Olympic level soccer players. And I'm like, thank God I did not say, oh, y'all play soccer. Like, these guys are doing like backflips and kicking the ball and stuff. And like, I'm like, holy shit. The thing is, what did I say? Her name was Jill. What name did I say? Julia? Yeah. But like, she's like out of breath in like a minute and a half. And like, she's never played soccer before. And I'm like, what is going on? And she comes up. She's like, oh, yeah, I'm really tired. And she's like, my friend Molly's here. I'm going to go talk with her. I'm like, all right. And so, like, her friend Molly is there. They go over, like they're, like, you know, about 20 meters away on, like, a bench talking to each other. And I'm, like, just, like, I'm in the middle of Peony, in the middle of nowhere. I'm, like, what is going, like, I'm, like, watching these dudes do, like, amazing soccer, you know, and I'm, like, sitting there. And then she comes back, like, about half hour later, she's like, you want to help me cook dinner? I'm, like, sure. So we go back to the market, and I buy all the food, right, which is fine. That's cool, you know. And then she's cooking food for all the dudes, which is fine. And I mean, it was a little gnarly, a little gnarly, a little hippy dippy, but whatever, you know, I'm trying to play it cool, you know, and the food was fine. But the weird thing was, is they each only had one bowl. So there was like three things. There was like salad, like faux mac and cheese and like something else. And they all took the salad and then put the mac and cheese on top and then something else on top of the mac and cheese. And I'm like, that is gross. Like I'm not the mac and cheese. But everyone's doing it, acting like it's the thing to do. So I'm just playing it cool, you know. And I'm like, all right, you know. So we actually had a nice time cooking dinner. We're having a good time, you know. And then the dudes all get up and run away. And I'm like, not one of these dudes like thanked her off my dime, mind you. But I didn't care about that, you know. Like, not one of these dudes like thanked her at all. So then we wash all the dishes, and she's like, well, I'm going to bed. No, I'm sorry. Then, like, the dudes came back down. They started playing, Risk. And apparently she had been playing Risk with them for, like, weeks. And she was like, I'm standing there watching everyone play Risk. I'm like, I don't know what the hell I'm supposed to do. You know what I mean? So they played Risk for, like, 20 minutes. And she's like, I'm going to bed. I'll see you tomorrow. I'm like, all right. And so I'm, like, hanging out with just talking to the dudes for, like, 45 minutes. Like, and they were actually pretty friendly. But I'm like, man, I don't want to be here, you know. So I go into my room, and I sleep, and I wake up. And the plan is the next morning we're going to go out to some canyon and look at some canyon, which is fine. You know what I mean? So we drive out to this canyon, and, we actually have to go, like, on this dirt road. Oh, before we drive to the canyon, she's like, oh, actually, I'm going to pick up a shift at my job, so we have to be back by 11. So I'm like, that's fine, you know, whatever. And so we go back to this, like, drive about an hour to this canyon, which is in the middle of nowhere, and we go on this dirt road, and my rental car is getting splashed in wet mud. We're driving, like, way off road. I'm like, oh, I hope I don't get stuck out here. So we get to the canyon, and we look at the canyon. It's not that big, and we're like, all right, well, let's head back. I'm like, all right. we're at the canyon for, like, 10 minutes. And I drive her back, and she's like, well, I'm going to pick up a shift. I'll probably only be a couple of hours. And I'm like, all right, well, I'm not trying to play it cool, but, you know, at this point, I'm like, what is going on? So she goes to a job at the bakery, which she loves baking, and she's a great baker. And I'm like, well, bizarrely enough, this tiny town has a coin car wash, which blew my mind, you know, but, like, thankfully, because I'm like, oh, my God, these car wash, like, if I took it back that way, they would have fined me, like, $500 for, like, destroying the car, you know. So I spend about an hour washing it off, you know. I start playing Yahtzee for like another hour on my phone. She texts me. She's like, oh, I'm going to be out by like 5 or 6. I'm like, all right. I'm like, well, whatever, you know? So then I'm like, well, I go to the small town and I go into the post office. And of course, like, this girl Molly is there or whatever. And apparently, like, she sees Julie like twice a day because it's such a small town, which is weird. I'm like, you know, oh, and I forgot, right when we came back, we got tacos before she went to work. And, like, she saw, like, her neighbor's cat, but we were, like, a half a mile away. She's like, oh, the cat must have got out of the house or whatever. I'm like, well, you think we should, like, take it back to their house? And she's like, no. And I'm like, My parents have outdoor cats, but like half a mile is a long way for a cat, you know. So anyways, I'm like, all right. So anyway, she goes to work. I'm spread out thing. I got like nothing to do, you know. I'm like, well, and I'm gonna be trying. I'm like, I gotta take a dump really bad, but I don't wanna go back to the house because I didn't really know how to get back there, and I didn't wanna go into these dudes' house and like take a dump and leave. So I go to the one Subway and I buy a bottle of water. And I say, can I have the key to the outdoor bathroom? And they're like, sure. But the outdoor bathroom is connected to the Subway. So I hear them like cleaning up on the other side while I'm taking like, I'm not trying to be my first dump in like 3 days. You know what I mean? It was rough, people. So I get out. I'm like, I don't know what to do, man. So I go to like the one shop, which is like a knickknack shop, except for like the only thing he's got is like shitty knickknacks that no one needs and like postcards. And I'm just like trying to kill time. So I'm like looking at every postcard. I'm like, I'll send my parents a postcard, I guess. And so, like, there's no prices on anything. And the dude's, like, staring at me. I'm in the shop for, like, 30 minutes just trying to kill time. I'm trying to kill time. And this dude's just staring at me. I'm like, so I finally pull a postcard. And he's like, okay, that's $1.14. And I'm like, oh, well, I only have a 20 on me, but I got some change. And I've got, like, 43 cents. I'm like, well, yeah, you want a 20? He's like, just give me the change. So I just got 43 cents. I'm like, and then I'm like, I don't know what to do, man. So I play some more Yahtzee on my phone, and I took a call from work, you know, and work's like, is like, well, you know, in this case, do you know why this was filed as docket number 17 instead of 9? I'm like, I don't know, Andy. I'm in friggin' Peonia, you know what I mean? Like, you know how many cases I have? I got 500 cases, right? And you got one case I don't care about, and I'm in Peonia. Anyways, so I like took like a 2-hour nap, but it was like uncomfortable because I was in the car, you know, and I'm like, oh my God, there's like nothing to do. I Googled where the nearest movie theater was. It was like 4 hours away. You know, the nearest record shop was literally like 7 hours away. I'm like, oh my God, there's no bowling alleys. Like, I'm thinking, I'm like, well, maybe I'll go bowling by myself. I got nothing to do. You know what I mean? There's like nothing. Nothing, you know. So anyway, at 5 o'clock, she's like, hey, I'm done at work. Can you come pick me up? So I go pick her up, and we go back to her house, and she's like, I'll be right back out. And you know, she's kind of like hippieing it up, which is cool, man. I'm not Mr. You know, men are men and women are, you know, she's got clothes are kind of old and stuff, but that's cool. I'm not a dick. She comes out and she's dressed like Cinderella. I'm like, holy shit, you know, like, and she's like, all right, well, we're going to my friend's art debut. I'm like, what the fuck? So I'm like, do I need to change? Because she's like, no, you're fine. I'm like, all right. So she's like, gorgeous. Like, she's looking great. You know what I mean? And so I'm like, what is going on? And she goes, oh, also, after the art show, there's going to be a flute demonstration. So we go to like this tiny ass art gallery in the middle of the town. It was really just like a house, but it's an art gallery. And there's some art on the walls, and it's fine, you know what I mean? But it's like I could have seen this in somebody's talented high schoolers could have done this. And I'm not trying to be a dick, but it was fine. And I'll point out here that my grandma wasn't a famous artist, but she got into some respected art shows on the East Coast. So I've been to many art galleries, and honestly, like, I've seen a lot of art, and some of it's really cool, and most of it is just okay. But art people are the flakiest, corniest people in the world, generally speaking. You know what I mean? And so everyone's walking around like, oh, I'm so moved by this picture of this man smiling. I'm like, yeah. So anyway, Julie says, oh, this is my friend Ken. He lives in the Bay Area too. You guys should talk. And so I'm talking to this dude, Ken. Like, and I'm not trying to be a dick. He's not trying to be a dick. And it turned out he knew the band Ceremony, but we're talking to each other. Like, we got nothing to talk. I'm like, I don't want to be talking to him. He don't want to be talking to me, but no one wants to be a dick. You know what I mean? And so I'm like, oh yeah. So anyway, I go walking around, and I see Julie outside, and there's one of the artists there. And this dude's big thing is he's got this driftwood that he puts perpendicular on a landscape and takes pictures of it. And he's got dozens of driftwood on landscapes. And it looks one looks kind of cool, you know, whatever. But he's got dozens, and people are like, oh, I'm so moved. I'm like, you're moved by driftwood? You know what I mean? Like it's fine. It's high school. It's maybe college. But it's not, like, amazing art. You know what I mean?
It was great.
So anyway, he's got, like, a basketball, and he's, like, bouncing it back to her. And also, like, one of her gay roommates is there. And he's a pretty feminine guy too. He's a nice guy. And so I definitely get the vibe that Julie has got the hots or is kind of into this art dude. You know what I mean? Like, I can tell, like, she knows him and there's some history there. You know what I mean? And I'm like, game over, man. Game over. Well, actually, I wasn't quite like game over. So like they're like playing like bouncing the basketball to each other. And the art dude, and this art dude is the corniest dude ever. He's got like the buzz short hair on the side and the long hair up top. He's got like a douchey mustache. Like, I hate this. I don't know about you guys, but sometimes I'll just meet someone for 3 seconds and I hate them and I know who exactly they are and I hate them. And I hate this guy is so freaking boring. You know what I mean?
No.
So anyways, her roommate, who's a pretty feminine guy, he's not a very athletic guy. I can tell he's bouncing the basketball especially hard to this guy who's not like why is this dude like kind of dogging on this dude? And her roommate, one of the roommates, he's like, I always hated high school gym. I always thought it was intimidating and pressure. And the art dude's like, really? That's what I liked about it. I'm like, you asshole. You know what I mean? You son of so. I'm like, and I can tell she's like digging this dude. I'm like, yeah, I don't know what's going on, but game over, man. Game over. You know, so I just like, they're all out of hors d'oeuvres. There's no hors d'oeuvres left, you know. So I'm like just like sitting around. So I go out. I'm so upset, you know. I'm so bummed out that I called my mom, which is like a really pathetic thing to do. But I called my mom and I'm like, Mom, you know, like just like nothing going on. I'm stuck out here. I kind of just want to leave right now, but it's like nighttime now, and I don't want to drive through the mountains and maybe be kind of weird, you know. And so my mom just kind of like, you know, trying to console me at the age of like 33 or 35, you know. So meanwhile, I'm walking around this town because I don't want to talk on the phone in their place. And like all the locals are like stepping out onto their porches looking at me because there's this weird dude walking around town talking to his mom on his phone, you know. I'm like, oh, my God. So anyways, I go back to the place. All the lights are out. It's locked. You know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, my God, everyone just totally bailed on me. This girl I met totally bailed on me. So I went to the bar where I heard people talking about. I go in. It's like an ultra redneck bar with, like, shotguns on the walls. There's, like, Skeeter, Beater, you know, Flytrap, and like, Moose there. And they look at me, and I look at them, and I can tell no one's in here. No one's been here for, like, 20 years. I'm like, oh, I went in the wrong door. And so I'm like bummed out. I'm like, man, it's like so I'm like, well, I got a bail. I mean, they bailed on me. I no point in hanging around. I'm trying to, I'm like, how the hell do I get back to this house? I know how to get there, and I don't want to like stay at the house. So I'm like, well, I'll go back to the house. I'll get my stuff. There's an abandoned hotel about 10 miles up the street, you know, a motel, and I'll just break in there and I'll sleep there because I don't want to drive over the mountains late at night, especially tired and kind of upset because I'll die. So I'll break into the hotel and just sleep there and then wake up tomorrow morning, drive back to friggin' Aspen, you know, the land of dreams, you know. And so I drive back to the house. No one's there. I climb in. The door's locked, so I climb in the window to break in. I get my suitcase. I go back. I put in my car, and I'm driving. I'm literally driving. I'm driving past the gas station that I came in, and my cell phone starts ringing. She's like, where are you? I'm like, where are you? She's like, we're at the art gallery. I'm like, what? And she's like, yeah, we're at the art gallery. I'm like, you are? She's like, yeah, where are you? I'm like, oh, I had to take a call from a client. They've got a good case coming up. So I'm, you know, I got good news, you know? So I'm like, I'll be right there. So I go there and she like lets me in. And apparently like, they're like all these hippie dippy people are like laying on the floor, listening to this person play this flute, which is like it's a high school flute performance. You know what I mean? It's like doo doo doo, and they're like laying on the floor. The lights are off except for like candles, and they're like laying on the floor. And she's like, I told you there was like a flute performance. I was like, oh yeah, I did forget because I was so upset. I didn't realize they would lock the door behind me, you know. So I like lay on the floor. And I'm still trying to play cool, even though it's totally a lost game. You know what I mean? And this person's playing this flute. Finally, it's over. They turn the lights. People are like, oh, that was wonderful. And they start asking them. And they're like, could you do it again? And the person's like, yeah. And everyone lays back on the floor. And this person's another 40-minute flute recital. I'm like, oh, my God, I want to kill myself. Like, this is brutal. You know, like, so anyways, the flute performance is over. And then I like kind of went outside because I don't know if she's planning on like hanging out with this dude or going somewhere. It's like I'm bummed out. I really just want to cut my losses and break into this motel so I can get a nice sleep. She comes out and she's like, all right, well, let's head on back. I'm like, all right, whatever, you know. So I go back and she's like, I'm going to bed. I was like, all right, you know. So she goes to bed, and then I'm like, well, listen, I know you got work tomorrow, so I'll just leave in the morning, you know, and then you know, and because it's all, I got a long drive, you know, it's been a long weekend. I'm trying to play it cool, like I'm trying not to show my hand. I'm like, so I'll just leave early in the morning, and you know, it was nice seeing you. We had a nice time, but she's like, well, I really want you to stay because I want to bake you some special food before you leave. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I'm like, fine. I'm like, this chick's been dodging me the whole weekend, and she wants me to stay to bake me some freaking baked goods, you know? I'm like, fine. She's like, can you wait till, like, 10 and come down to the bakery at 10? I'm like, fine, you know? So, like I think I did, like, it's cold. You know, I fall asleep. I wake up. I go down to Bakery 10. She's down there, and she's like baked me like all these croissants, all these like not pizza, but kind of like pizza, like all these danishes. And she's like, I made these for you. I'm like, wow. I'm like, thanks. So I like eat one, and it is totally delicious. I'm like, wow. I'm like, wow. Like, that's really good. And then I'm like, she's standing like she expects me to eat like 10 danishes. And I'm like, can I have a box? I'll eat one more, but you know, I got a long drive. I don't want to eat all these danishes now, you know? So she gives me like a box, and I'm like, well, time to head on out. And she like hugs me and starts crying that I'm leaving. Like, she doesn't want me to leave. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, you've been dodging me like for like 3 days or 2 days. It's really only like a day, but I felt like 7 days. And she's like crying, and she's like, it was really great seeing you. I'm like, yeah, it was great seeing you. And then I drove 3.5 hours back to Aspen and flew home. And I have no idea what the deal was. No idea. I have no moral. Every dude that's not a Fabio has got a, you know, flew out, drove out to meet a girl, and it went terribly. And that's my story. And I have no idea what was going on. I have no idea. Like, I'm like, is this girl trying to give me some signals? Like, maybe I should go knock on the door. And she says she's going, but she's clinging to this art dude, you know, and she's blowing me off of the art dude. You know, I have no idea. It was one of the weirdest weekends I ever had.
You know, you could have just asked her. You could have just asked her, what's the deal? Do you want me here? No, this feels weird.
Well, that's why I said, you know, I'll just leave early. But then she's like, I mean, I should have been more direct. But like I don't know, man. Like, I should have said it out. I guess I was trying to be a gentleman and not say, if I come out, am I going to get some action? Like, I didn't want to say that. You know what I mean? Like, but like, I didn't want to be like, so why am I coming out? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, ma'am. I don't know.
Well, could I ask, is peonia, is that another word for peyote? Like,
it's another round for the most boringest town in the United States of America, where there's nothing going on. And the only store is a postcard store, and it sucks as a postcard store.
I'm really into like reenacting that flute recital. So when I see you one time, John,
oh god,
I'm gonna get a flute for you. We'll lay on the floor again.
It was brutal, and everyone's like, "Oh, it's so wonderful." I'm like, really? You know, I don't think I'm like a Philistine, but I'm like, what? You know. Anyways, that's my story,
man. It moved me.
I wonder if she had, maybe she harbored some bad feelings about your relationship. Was she trying to exact revenge upon you? Was this all an elaborate scheme to exact some revenge?
I hear you, but and like flaunt the art dude in front of me. But then why like ask me to stay and cook me all these delicious baked goods and then cry when I'm about to leave?
All right, I can't end this weird story without putting out one proposed theory. Got 2 minutes?
Yeah.
What proposed theory? You know that show, What We Do in the Shadows?
No.
So What We Do in Shadows is kind of like a mockumentary about vampires that live on Staten Island. So that's why I watch it, because it's like, oh, talking about Staten Island, whatever. So one of the vampires has, throughout time, a romantic relationship with a guy that she calls Gregor, who like comes in and out reincarnated in different bodies. So I'm convinced that this woman... person that you were seeing must have thought you were her Gregor and that you had been reincarnated, but maybe misread those signals. So what you had to do was you had to behead someone in Aeonia to show.
I was ready to behead a lot of people, let me tell you.
Now, see, I think the art guy was Gregor. So I think she had a plan to have like a hookup weekend with John, but she didn't realize it was the like once in, you know, a blue moon that her Gregor was going to be coming back to life and visiting her to have their like, you know, their ongoing romance. So John got pushed aside.
Maybe that was it. I mean, who knows? I don't know. And I thought about asking her like what the deal is, but I'm like, what's the point? I'm not going to fly back out there. You know what I mean? I'm like,
that's a long way to go not to ask, but you know what?
Well, I'm nothing if not short-sighted and stubborn. You know what I mean? So, Hallie Bullitt, hit us with your weird story, and we will wrap this very special episode up.
All right, I gotta try to make this quick, right? This is a long episode. The first tour that the Unlovables ever did was with the Ergs, and it was the first time we were going on the road at all, and it was the first time that they were ever playing the West Coast. And so we were all like really new, you know, we were all still like trying to build our bands into anything. We were really still like basically like nobody. And we were going to do this West Coast tour together. And the Ergs were doing like, they were doing a much larger tour. And so they just were overwhelmed and they ended up just sort of like not having time to book the West Coast tours. And so I was booking them all myself. I'd never booked a tour. I had no idea what I was doing. I was literally just totally winging it. And I kept checking in with Joe Ergen being like, I don't know. I found this like biker bar that's willing to let us play. He was like, just book it. Just book it. We just need shows. Like, just do it. Like, just, okay. And I was like, okay, I guess I'll just book it. And we start this tour, you guys. And it is just like, you know, the thing is, as a band, the first time you tour any part of the country, like, you're probably going to eat shit unless you're just incredibly lucky and have, like, I don't know, had like a much larger band take you out on the road with them, or you've like had some like mega hit somehow without ever playing a tour. But if you're just a regular band hitting the road for the first time, it's just your first tour is going to suck. You just have to get it over with and just accept the suckage and like know that what happens is that then you go back to each of those cities, and every time you go back, it gets better and better. It's like really a beautiful thing, right? It's like you plant this seed in each city, and when you first get there, there's nothing, but you plant the seed, and then every time you go back to the city, you get to go back and watch what you planted. You get to watch it grow, and more people come to your shows. But like, so here we are, like, it's our first time in any of these cities, and the shows are just bad. They're bad. We play the Spiker Bar. The only people that show, it was like in San Jose, I think, California. And my mother happened to be doing a theatrical production of Gypsy in like a nearby town at the time. And so literally the only people that showed up were like a bunch of bikers that did not want to hear pop punk. And then like, the cast of Gypsy, a regional theater production of Gypsy, who like danced in like the most embarrassing way that only musical theater people do when they're like socially dancing, like just like so too much. And the Ergs are just looking at me like, what have you done to us? And I'm just like, you could have booked the show. Like, to me, I did the best that I could. And so then we did have a handful of shows on that tour that like friends had booked for us, which should have been better and were like somewhat better, but still just, it was like nothing but weird. We played at like a show in Sacramento with this old band, The Secretions, which were like a Ramones core kind of like, they were really nice guys, but like, I don't know. They had an album called like We Secrete, You Suck. And then like another album called like Faster Than the Speed of Drunk, you know? So it was just like, it was that kind of pop punk. And they set up this show for us. And like the only other band on the bill was like this acid hardcore metal band. All I remember is that they had a banner that they nailed into the wall of the venue as they played, like almost like performance art. And I don't remember the banner having the name of their band on it. I just remember that the banner had a bunch of dildos sticking off of it.
Whoa.
So we played this show with this, like, I don't remember the name of this band, and The Secretions. And then we get up to play like our like completely like, you know, girly like pop punk song. It's like, at least The Secretions, it was pop punk, but at least it was like obnoxious pop punk. And it was like kind of a little, I don't want to say bro-y because they weren't bro-y, but you know what I'm talking about, right? At least they could kind of hold their own on a bill with this other band, but like we had no business being on the same bill as this band. And then we got done with the show, we're just like feeling bad about the whole thing, and my guitarist Frank went to go use the bathroom, and the guy from the dildo band walked into the bathroom at the same time. And Frank is very like tall and thin, and he was wearing a striped shirt. And the guy goes, hey man, where's Waldo? And he shoved Frank into the bathroom.
Oh god. This is high school.
Our band had just played with his band, and he shoved he said, where's Waldo? And he shoved him into a bathroom stall. We continued down the coast. We like played a show in San Diego that our friends Vina Cava had set up for us, where one of the bands set up a tent, like a two-man tent, like a pup tent, and they played their entire set from inside the tent, like with just like a recorder would stick out the window and be like, burr, 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 burr. And then like a trumpet would stick out another window. It was like completely Actually, that was like pretty amazing. And then
that's pretty cool.
Our friends Vina Kava, but just like all the shows were weird. But I don't know, it was like amazing too, because it's your first time touring and you can't believe you're doing it. And if anyone like shows up to see you play, or one person buys a CD, you just are, it's like such exhilaration. You're like, we're doing this. Like, we play a show. Like, no one came, but like, we did play a show in the city we've never been to before. And the Ergs had never been to the West Coast at all. Just not just as a band, but like as people. Like, none of those three guys had been to the West Coast before. And so they were like, well, we have to go into the Pacific Ocean. This is, I think, when we were in San Diego. But like, they're punks, right? Like, none of them had brought bathing suits. Like, they didn't even own shorts. Like, they didn't even have shorts. Like, in fact, Jeff Erg had one pair of shorts that was for the band Sugar. Like, Bob Mould's band Sugar. Like, what band has shorts made? Like, he used to always make fun of Jeff Erg's Sugar shorts, but at least he had shorts to wear into the ocean. Joe Erg had to cut his jeans. He had a pair of jeans that he decided was like his least favorite jeans that he'd brought on tour. And he like cut them into jean shorts so that we could all like jump in the ocean together. And it was like fucking beautiful. It was awesome. And then like we ended the tour, I think like towards the end of the tour, we were in Laramie, and Teenage Bottle Rocket like took us fishing in the mountains. And then like when it was time to go home, we cried. Well, at least the Unlovables cried. The Argus, they're not big criers, but the Unlovables like all cried when it was time to go home from what was absolutely like an abysmal tour from like a music standpoint. But like we loved it. It was one of the weirdest tour I've ever been on, but also just great.
Well, fantastic. Great way to end on a stroke of positivity. So Hallie, M, Chris, thank you for sharing your stories, the happy ones, the sad ones. And I hope the listeners learned a little bit about us and a little bit about themselves. You can reach the podcast at punknews.org. And we will close this out with perhaps the weirdest track I know that is not trying to be weird. And that's McGruff the Crime Dog singing about why you should not do inhalants. This is McGruff the Crime Dog. Yeah. See you next week.
Deadly poisons when inhaled. Don't ever try it. Just say no to inhalants. Breathing them is really no thrill. Don't you know inhalants really can kill?
Don't do inhalants.
You'll be suffering pain.
Don't do inhalants.
They will damage your brain.
Don't do inhalants.
Cause it's really insane. Cause inhalants. Be suffering pain.
Don't do inhalants.
They will damage your brain.
Don't do inhalants.